if you, I'll give you an opportunity to correct me or kill me. Milwa took us through inspection and enforcement, and, that being one of the critical areas, as well as the challenges. The portfolio committee raised issues around education, as well as vendors, the regulation of such, and the challenges around particularly occupational health and safety. What I learned personally from the presentation is the effort that is done to make sure that occupational health and safety is in fact a subject that is taught, because it covers the whole spectrum of our lives, and I think it's, you know, quite a good initiative. Sam took us through some October on public employment services. Very informative presentation, which dealt with the public employment services, and one of the critical slides that I took quite comfort in, I think at the end of the presentation I went back to, was the impact in terms of placements that the department is making, as well as the achievement of its APP targets, which is quite an important aspect, and of course giving recognition to the efforts that the department is making to attend to unemployment in the country. Nolkolo covered, dealt with the process of the APP and strat plan. That was a fairly straightforward presentation, and Professor Singh also dealt with the executive previous advisory boards, which was more an information sharing session of the roles, particularly of each of these boards too, in the department, and the value of advice and information and the consultation process that they are responsible for, and how that assists us. Tebogo Maruping dealt with the UIF. Very informative and valuable presentation on the impact that the funds, unemployment insurance funds, are making in terms of taking care of unemployment, the different projects that they've been involved in, where they've helped, EDCON being one, and the state of readiness or assessment that they did in the case that things go south at SAA. And we closed off with Vuyo Mafata on the compensation fund. We thank him for not opening his can of worms. And he also took us through the work that they do and the challenges that the fund is facing. So that was basically it in terms of how we dealt with the issues yesterday. I had hoped to complete this summer when Netley was here, so that we assist them in terms of what is expected from the presentation. But be that as it may, this morning we're going to start off with the CCMA and Cameron Morachane will kick off and take us through the presentation. Then we'll have Dr. Nandi Dabula from Productivity SA and Mr. Mkalipi from NEDLAC. Ladies and gentlemen, unless there are any questions, queries or concerns, issues to raise, I would like to, it's now 9:15, I'd like to proceed with Mr. Morachane. just remind Tebogo of our arrangement. Thank you. Chair?
If sorry for this, because it's messing up with time, that light breakfast is served. So if you can get just some 10 minutes for members and our guests to get whatever. Because this thing of up and down when somebody's presented, I don't like it. So just 10 minutes, if that's fine with you.
That's fine. We could do have rescue drops in the event that you need them. Thank you and welcome. Nabundu.
Good morning, Chair, and good morning, honorable members and colleagues. My name is Nabundu Sibisi. I'm the head of program operations at Medlec, and I bring apologies from Mr. Kalipi, who is the acting executive director at Medlec. He's currently attending another meeting in cabinet. Thank you.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to proceed with Cameron. Over to you.
Members, good morning, Chairperson and our program director, and my colleagues. The advantage and the disadvantage of presenting the second day, the advantage is that at least you understand the brief better. The disadvantage is that you must stick to the brief that you understand. So I have listened to the chairperson yesterday that we mustn't be too tight because this is a this is a workshop and we must be able to engage with the members to understand exactly our environment and the issues that you have to deal with. And what I heard very clear was that labor law is a law issue. Chairperson, that's what you said yesterday. And I will do just that. Over and above that, the greater part of the presentation, therefore, will not rely mainly on the slides. There's just three or four slides that I referred to on the presentation. The rest are the issues that are in the context of the workshop, which I think I hope will be very beneficial. I'll try to pitch it at a sufficiently high level, not in terms of detail, but in terms of content. So that I can deal with that. Chairperson, this may be too obvious, but I'm going to do it. Because at the CCM, before I start with the statutory approach, I want to read this important statement. It will be recognized because this is the spirit I believe is missing. Us as institutions. It reads as thus. And I will explain why, and I raise issues that the context will become clearer. It says, Chairperson, we, the people of South Africa, recognize the injustice of our past, honor those who suffered for justice and freedom in our land, respect those who have worked to build and develop our country, and believe that South Africa belongs to all who live in it, united in our diversity. We therefore, through our freely elected representatives, adopt this constitution as the supreme law of the Republic, so as to heal the divisions of the past and establish a society based on democratic values, social justice, and fundamental human rights. Lay the foundation for a democratic and open society in which government is based on the will of the people, a and every citizen is equally protected by law. Improve the quality of life of all citizens and free the potential of each person. And build a united and democratic South Africa able to take its rightful place as a sovereign state in the family of nations. May God protect our people. Unquote. Chairperson, in every presentation as a leader of an entity of government, I've taken it upon myself to ensure that I take every opportunity to remind our people the foundations of our South African Constitution, because the spirit and the values of our country and our spirit is reflected in that preamble. Every right and every freedom we read in our Constitution must be driven and directed by the spirit, purport and object that are purported in the Constitution. Now I'm reading that chapter as an introduction to that because there are certain parts of that preamble that has found its way into the employment law and as a result creating the complications, some of which that you spoke about yesterday. And I'll be very specific when it comes to that on why I think it is important and why I think that each and every one of us must be revived and be reminded about exactly what I've just read. It is not just a beautiful looking statement that is attached to a constitution. It is a constitutional obligation. And as a result of that, we have to comply. But I believe that in some respects, which I will show, we have deviated from that. And as a result, we've got problems. Let me proceed, Chairperson. There's only three slides I'll talk to. The rest are the issues, workshop format I will raise and make clear submissions, problem and possible solution to that. Let's proceed to slide number three. Chairperson, slide number three, you said we talk law as well because labor law is law and that's what I'm going to do and simplify it afterwards. If you look at that slide, that slide is called the employment law framework. What we are operating, if you look at the presentation that was given yesterday, it is not outside that. And it is by no means a complete conspectus of legislation that is operating within employment law. It's not. These are the key ones we can do with, we can't do without, because they are the founding statutes that we operate under. Let me start first with our constitution, because the ILO, which is the top part, the International Labour Organization, it is introduced into our system through Section 39 of the Constitution. Section 39 of the Constitution is our interpretations clause. And in that interpretations clause, it says that in interpreting the human rights and interpreting our statute, which is what you see in front of you, we must have regard to foreign law and we must have regard to international law, which effectively means that the conventions that Virgil was talking about, including the regulations that are issued in terms of those conventions, must be taken into account when interpreting our own constitution and interpreting our statute, which practically means when we interpret the Labour Relations Act, the minimum wage, your basic conditions and all of that, we must not forget, as is stated in our preamble, that we are a sovereign state, but we are part of the family of nations. Some of the problems that we have, especially, for example, when we had the problem with Section 198 of the Labour Broadcast, the interpretation that the court has adopted in resolving that dispute actually had regard to what the international community is saying with regards to the Labour Broadcast. But the problem that we have in the interpretation of our laws, we seem to be domesticated in understanding what it's supposed to mean. My submission, therefore, Chairperson, with regards to the obligations you find in the preamble and the obligations imposed on us on our Supreme Constitution in terms of Section 4, we must have regard to that for us to have a proper understanding of our actual obligations. Having said so, therefore, Chairperson, our environment that we operate under is based on this statute. For the purpose of the CCMA, we are founded by one statute. That is the Labour Relations Act. This is the founding statute of the CCMA. One perception that must be corrected is that the LRA was not created to create the CCMA. The CCMA is a product of the creation of the LRA, because we're an institution of statutory creation. And it's not the only institution created by that. There are other institutions and processes. So that must be absolutely clear. Over and above that, and quite importantly, is the national minimum wage. I will talk about that, Chairperson, because that comes with its own problems. It's going to discuss it as part of what I call death by legislation. Because if everyone raises issues with you in the context of what we find to be a problem, I will write that within that context. So in as far as the employment law framework, that's the framework. What you must also note, Chairperson, is that there's a lot of duplication in our legislation. As a result, is causing interpretational problems. I will demonstrate. If you read the national minimum wage, it will tell you, in the main, the national minimum wage creates the 20 rand, the 18 rand, the 15 rand, the 11 rand. That's what it does. But for you to be able to execute it, you can't use the national minimum wage. You must rely on the Basic Conditions of Employment Act. That's what it means. And there's cross-referencing between the Basic Conditions of Employment Act and the national minimum wage. So for our people, especially those that are unsophisticated, it is too complicated to understand the dispute resolution process because of the multiplicity of statutes involved in execution. I will deal with that in specifically later, and there's new amendments and all of that. The Employment Equity Act. Chairperson, we as the CCMA, we have now an expanded jurisdiction, which now includes, broadly, the Employment Equity Act. Chairperson, it is painful sometimes to note that people take the employment equity for granted. If there's any statute in the legal framework that is born directly from the bellies of the Constitution, it is the Employment Equity Act, specifically the Equality Clause. That clause in the Constitution, the Equality Clause, it's extremely important because what I've read in the preamble when you're talking about equal protection of the law and all of that, it is also linked to that Equality Clause. Therefore, our execution, if we're to achieve equity in the country, it is not possible unless you fully implement the Employment Equity Act because it is directly born from the Equality Clause of our Constitution. If you frustrate the Employment Equity Act, you are frustrating the Equality Clause. Therefore, when we execute that mandate that's given to the CCMA based on the employment equity, we must be conscious of that. Because that's the essence of the Employment Equity Act. All these rights that are there, equality in terms of sexual orientation, race, color, gender, religion, culture, which I will talk about, is protected in the Constitution, but for the wills of implementation of the Constitution is national legislation. Remember, Chairperson, that Section 36 of the Constitution, which is the Limitations Clause, says that the rights contained and freedoms contained in the Constitution can only be limited by a law of general application. And everything I've mentioned in that framework is law of general application. Remember, we've got a difference between an original legislation and a delegated legislation. My obsession is on the delegate, not the delegated one, is the original, because that's the one that limits the human rights. That's how we got the death penalty declared unconstitutional, just based on the Criminal Procedure Act, but interpreting Section 36 with Section 39. Let me revert back, Chairperson, then to the brief. If you look at the national minimum wage and you specifically look at the definition of what employment law means there, you will find that in the jurisdiction of the CCMA, since we have the national minimum wage, but it expands to include, amongst other things, the Occupational Health and Safety, UIF, UIF Act, and all of that. That you will find in the definition in the national minimum wage. You see, there's a rule in law that says the legislature, which is yourself, you will not create a law unless there's a problem. It's called a mischief rule. When the national minimum wage was created, there was a problem because we've got an issue of poverty, we've got an issue of unemployment, we've got an issue of equity. So the creation of the national minimum wage, that was creating certain minimum standards for achieving that, And therefore, the legislature, which is this House Senate, CCMA, together with the Department of Employment and Labor, you shall execute this and make it a reality. But there are problems, Jefferson, which I will deal with, if I still have time. That's my Uchava declaration under the circumstances. Now, let me proceed to paragraph 6, because slide number 6, so that I can deal with the specific issues that I'm raising for you. So let's go to slide number 5. Jefferson, I will not take you through this because here's what is important to note. If there's anything to remember about what the CCMA does, there's two broad mandates that we have. We've got mandatory functions, we've got discretionary functions. And if you want to find it in the statute, you'll find it in terms of section 115. That's the law. That's where the CCMA's broad mandate is sitting, both the discretionary and the mandatory one. The mandatory one is mentioned on page 5, and the discretionary is on slide number 6. I will not take you through the individual ones because there's specific issues I want to raise with regards to that. Now, I will talk to slide number 8 later. Let me proceed to one important point for the purpose of the workshop of what you've raised. Jefferson, here's the problem that we have. We've got what we call the principle of the separation of powers. So you find the legislature, you find the executive, you find the judiciary. And these laws that we're talking about are interpreted by the courts, which is the arm of the judiciary. Now, in our preamble, you have that specific clause that says that South Africa belongs to all of those who live in it. That's what our preamble says. Then we had certain specific cases that came before the doors of the CCMA, which in particular dealt with foreign nationals, or those that don't have work permits, they call it. And there was an argument that was raised at the Labour Court that said that those, therefore, that don't have work permits cannot work in South Africa or don't have contracts. Therefore, CCMA and the Labour Court do not have jurisdiction. That's wrong. Why? Because that's what our Labour Court said. Our Labour Court said that when it comes to employment relationship, it is different from a contract of employment. And our constitution says that South Africa belongs to all of those who live in it. Now, what you find then that becomes a problem, therefore, it is a tension between the executive and the judiciary. In that, our preamble says everyone who lives in it, but our statutes does not specifically provide. That's why you find now that there's this statutory tension between the Migration Act, the Labor Relations Act, the constitution, which now gives a certain animal we can't describe. But one thing that is very clear, foreign nationals, in the discovery case, there's a number of them, has confirmed that even if you don't have a work permit, the CCMA and the Labour Courts have jurisdiction to hear your case. But it does not necessarily make you an employee, but it makes you a worker, which is defined in Section 239 of the South African Constitution. What we have not found, which is what I submit, we need judicial and legislative clarity on that point. Because you can't have our preamble saying South Africa belongs to all of those who live in it. Then you have an immigration case that you are an immigrant, therefore you are not an employee. The constitution says you are a worker. The labor court says we have jurisdiction, so is the CCMA. Now I'm raising legal questions. That is an issue. That is an issue. But I can confirm that our courts have confirmed that we have jurisdiction, so is the CCMA. That somebody who is unfairly dismissed, who does not work permit, will found that those dismissals are unfair, and the courts have confirmed it. That's where we're sitting, but we need clarity. That's why we've got these xenophobic issues and people taking our jobs, and we were discussing that last time when we, with the road freight bargaining council, that there's this 40-60 rule created that employers are permitted to employ 40% foreigners and 60% local issue. You see, the problem there, Chairperson, is that that's what Home Affairs is saying. But what Home Affairs is saying is not in line with what I've just presented. So there's that statutory problem that we have, policy, law, constitution, and judiciary. So this confusion, therefore, within the mandate of this House, that we need that clarity, I submit. And therefore, put simply, that's what we call conflict of laws. Point 2, enforcement. Chairperson, Mrs. Egi presented yesterday what is seen as enforcement. And every time I ask a question, who is responsible for enforcement, I always get different answers. Who are the institutions that are involved in enforcement, I get different answers. Let me clarify. You have the Department of Employment and Labor, Inspection and Enforcement, Mrs. Egi. Now in terms of the new jurisdiction, you've got the CCMA that is also responsible for enforcement. You've got the courts also have jurisdiction for enforcement. And you've got these people who are very strange, but we use them called sheriffs, who are quite frustrating, right? I can tell you now, it's frustrating. And let me explain. In this country, if there's a court, a compliance order issued by the Department of Employment and Labor, an award issued by the CCMA that is not executed or enforced, we better not even have those institutions. Because the value of enforcement is not the document you issue, it is the content of what you issued. Let me explain. If the award says reinstate and pay, the employer says no, what's the value of that award? How many compliance orders are issued by the Department of Employment and Labor, that remains unexecuted because they are ignored? How many cases are pending at court now, subject to Section 145 and Section 148 on review? They're ignored. So, what does therefore enforcement mean? Enforcement means not the award issue. That is just a tool. Enforcement means that if they say reinstate me, that's the only language. The only language that the beneficiary of that award understands. Chairperson, it is painful that you must note that the magistrate courts, now I'm submitting a problem also, based on the same principle of enforcement, magistrate courts are brought into the employment law framework through Section 143 of the LLA, which means they must enforce, they must attach. Let me explain it differently. Yes, that has started. When you issue an award, when you issue a compliance order, and especially the one that sounds in money, you take it to the employer and say, you must pay this worker 10,000 rand. They refuse. They say, these assets belong to somebody else. It's even worse, Chairperson, when it comes to domestic workers. Because there you've got two problems, the accessibility. Number two, you don't know who is the respondent. When a husband is brought to the CCMA and says, no, she's not employed by me, she's employed by the wife. The wife comes, no, it's the husband. That's another issue. The playing games, right? That's the first part. In the farms, they've now established new policies of access, which means, therefore, in the execution of these laws, I'm talking about, becomes an impossibility because there's new problems created. That's okay. But here's the problem with the assets. When the sheriff goes and attaches, and they say, no, this does not belong to me, it belongs to somebody else. So it means now you're starting a new process that is justiciable at the match court. And match court is brought by Section 143, but magistrates are refusing to do those processes. This is the effect of that. We call it the interpleader process in law, right? So it means, therefore, if we don't agree that the assets that I'm attaching do not belong to the respondent appearing in the award, we must then proceed to the match court, to the match court, to decide on exactly who does this belong to. But if the magistrate court, who has jurisdiction because of Section 143 of the LRA, refuses to do so, what does it mean? It means that the award is dead, and there's many of them. We then approached members of parliament and said, therefore, that section must be amended to exclude the match court. It is easier if that mandate is in terms of Section 158 in the labor court, because then that is executable using a different method, that the interpreter can be dealt with properly there within the labor court framework. So that is a problem. So what am I submitting to you, Chairperson, is that there are, you see, when the Labor Relations Act was created, like I said, it is because it enforces Section 185, Section 188, and most importantly, Section 23 of the Constitution. Now, I will talk about that because now the South African Human Rights is making new approaches to make Section 23 not a Labor Relations Act issue only, but to make it a constitutional problem. Because Section 23 says it's a protection of labor rights. That's the primary clause. And our approach has always been that the problems of employment law are labor law problems. No, they are not labor law problems. They are constitutional problems. Because that all these employment laws that I spoke about, the umbilical cord is directed to Section 23 of the Constitution. So if you unfairly dismiss, you're violating the Constitution. Effectively. That's what the Human Rights Commission's approach is taking now. I'm not sure where it's heading, because it's going to create a problem jurisdictionally now, because if they can litigate on Section 23 having regard to the employment laws that we have. So that's the problem that we have. Closing on enforcement, Chairperson, enforcing outcomes of processes, one of the biggest problems is the disintegrated approach we take in doing them. Enforcement must not be disintegrated, it must be integrated. You see, at any given time, the beneficiaries of this enforcement must never be in two minds where to go if there's an issue of enforcement. Must never. You mustn't think, should I go to court? You see, the other day, Chairperson, one of the things that happened, people do strange things. There's a bunch of cases that were stuck because there was a problem of interpretation, that cases that came before the 1st January 2019, should they be at court or should they be at the CCMA because they are new, or should they continue with Department of Employment and Labor? Other people still expect the CCMA to give compliance orders, but they're only done by the Department of Employment and Labor. We issue awards, not the compliance orders, but we make compliance orders awards of the CCMA. That's the new order. So when I say disintegration, I'm saying that it should not, it must not become a problem. There must be a coherent, comprehensive, integrated approach to enforcement. Because those that benefit from it must not have the pain of getting what they're supposed to get and still have a problem of where to go for enforcement. But there is an attitude of blatant disregards of instruments of law such as award compliance orders. I'm submitting that members know there is a problem of disregard. That must stop. I'm clear about that part. Chairperson, yesterday you mentioned something important, that we must not work in silos. That's fundamental. Which means, therefore, it enforces what I just said, because between us and inspection enforcement, for example, we work closely because we're from the same family. But what is important is the creation of these important partnerships. You see, Chairperson, what I've realized is that we are all equally liable as entities, because the issue of silos does not even have to arise. It's something that we must do automatically. And this is what we've done. We've created a clear written memorandum of understanding with the Employment Equity Commission, for example, with Productivity SA, with the South African Human Rights Commission, and all of that. Because the pursuit of this principle, why we do that, including the ILO, we've done the same thing. Because you see, here's the problem, Chairperson, if you have disintegration, if a worker who is dismissed seeks justice, they go to department seeking social justice, she's told there's no jurisdiction, go to the CCMA, they walk to the CCMA, and they get that, no, you don't have jurisdiction, you go to the bargaining council. No, you don't have jurisdiction, you go to that round. And you're talking about somebody who's walking hungry because they're dismissed. Firstly, they can't even afford transport money. Some of them walk for kilometers just to get to that office for that to be implemented. But we do not have an integrated system that links that. If you come to the Human Rights Commission, you feel that it's a human rights issue, but it's actually the labor rights issue. We must be able to do that without sending them from pillar to post, seamlessly. Because this is what happens. So somebody goes to the Employment Equity Commission because they feel discriminated. When they get there, says, but your issue is an employment equity problem. You should be in the CCMA. By the time they get to us, they're out of time, they must apply for condonation. They don't even know how to do it. But by the time they apply for compensation, if they can't justify it, the matter is dismissed. But if you have an integrated system, then wherever they land in an entity of government, we must be able to assist without sending them from pillar to post. Pure and simple. I call it the integrated approach. That's why, from the CCMA, we created those partnerships. Because we're trying to make sure that that does not happen. Let me talk to the next point. Death by legislation. Jefferson, it is correct. And I've shown that I don't know how many labor legislations do we have. Each and every one of them prescribes dispute resolution process that must be followed. It is correct that at no stage did we make an evaluation that when we created the Labor Relations Act, when we created the Employment Equity Act, what is it that we were resolving as legislature? We said there must be equity in the workplace. That was the point. But did we achieve it? When we got jurisdiction to deal with issues of employment equity, why did we do that? Did we achieve it? So the bottom line in the submission I'm making, Jefferson, on the point that you raised, because it requires a direct answer, there is no evaluation of legislative impact. There isn't. It must be done. Now, over and above that, here's my submission. As we think of legislating, we must evaluate whether what we are trying to legislate cannot be covered by the existing legislation. I'll give an example. The national minimum wage is a very small statute. You know, volume is very few clauses in the national minimum wage. But the biggest part of it for it to exist, it is in the Basic Conditions of Employment Act. So the question is, was it possible to incorporate the provisions of the national minimum wage in the Basic Conditions of Employment Act? Because the fact that it's part of another statute does not make it less of a law. Because the multiplicity of legislation therefore creating interpretational problems. What you're facing now is debates about who has jurisdiction in what because of the different statutes that apply. And you find also the usage of terminology in the different statutes is also different, but they're talking about the same thing. We spend time on jurisdictional interpretational problems than the actual substantive issue. That's a problem. You remember, Chairperson, before the national minimum wage was made a statute, the biggest debate was the difference between the definition of work and the definition of employee. Take a test. Take the Occupational Health and Compensation Act, take the other and the basic conditions. Look at the definitions, you'll see the difference. But they're talking about the same work. This is the problem of the death by legislation issue. So there must be a synchronization. Even if there's multiplicity of statutes, but there must be consistent interpretations of those provisions. You see, when you're talking about sex workers, the Kylie case that went to the Labour Appeal Court, the reason why Kylie succeeded at the LEC is not because she was an employee, because she was a worker. And that is drawn from the constitution, not from the statute. Do you see the difference what I'm talking about? It doesn't mean that law promotes sex work. No. It's law that says so, because that's how we've defined it, and the Constitution protects that. So it is very important, therefore, that we do that coherent statutory assessment so that we can see if we're achieving with regards to that. Chairperson, I took interest on the submission that was made yesterday on the relationship between entities and the boards. I have a question and a submission. You see, there's this continuous debate that must stop because we need clarity on it. That the creation of these entities such as the CCM is created by statute called the Labor Relations Act. But there seems to be an issue about issues of governance. I'll give you an example. So when you appoint members of the board, of these boards, including the CCM, you've got social partners, you've got workers, you've got business, you've got government. So when they're sitting at the CCMA as an entity, you're talking about King Four now. Whose interests are they serving? Those of the entity or those that they represent? That question was not dealt with yesterday. So therefore, there's this Companies Act versus the statute that creates that entity you're talking about that needs to be, that you have to need clarity about. Let's leave that. Now, here's something that I'm very passionate about. Section 13, Section 31 of the Constitution, called Language and Culture and the Impact of That. Chairperson, I attended an international conference in Canada last year, where you have other entities like the CCMA there. And one of the representatives of the United States said that never underestimate the role, weight, and importance of language and culture in dispute resolution. Language and culture in dispute resolution. Let me explain. So, if the commissioner of the CCMA is black and will take his cause, the worker speaks his cause, the representative of the employer will take his cause, why is it done in English? You've got 11 different official languages. How many awards have you seen or compliance orders that are done in suit or any language other than English? They used to be in Afrikaans. So, if you ask a worker to tell his story, or we are talking about, what is the best way for that person to put their case? It's cause. Not only will they understand the dispute better, they can appreciate the process. And if they are to resolve the dispute, they must resolve the dispute they understand. But now it's done through translation. Why? You see, my argument and submission to you is that issues of 11 language must not be a token. It must be practical. It will contribute into dispute resolution because people understand the dispute in the language of their choice. Here's an additional problem to that. How many CCMAs or offices of what we do are in the townships? They're all in towns. Why? Why is that? Because more than 70% were dismissed from the township. So why can't then other races then get into a taxi or get in the car and go to Heidelberg or go to somewhere to Ofinbaba to do a conciliation there with the commissioner appointed in the language that is understood? They don't have to board the taxi, they don't have to go to a bus, because they don't have money anyway, because they've been dismissed anyway. It's called access to justice. It's done in my language, and I'm able to access it without complications. Chairperson, the reality is that even those that are employed can hardly finish a month with the salary they get, but imagine for those that don't even have a salary, and sometimes for months. I'll come to that when I come to the issue of judgment that take 10 years to resolve and will pay impact, because we're ignoring those things. I know Chairperson said it's a workshop, we're not talking slides, we're talking issues. That's what I'm raising. Matters that you need to know about. Now, over and above that, so I'm submitting, Chairperson, that we must therefore review and do what the Constitution says, that this country has 11 languages, that when you're talking about the Republic of South Africa, it does not exclude township, it includes them. Therefore, these institutions of dispute resolution must be established in each and every one of them, not just in suburbs. And the language must be correct. That will resolve disputes. Sometimes the disputes are not resolved, not because people are refusing, but because they don't understand. That's the problem. That's the problem. And Chairperson, let me submit while saying that one of the defenses that you get when you're talking about arbitrations be done in other language other than in English and Afrikaans, they say it's expensive. Why is it expensive to exercise my culture and customs? And they even tell you, Chairperson, that if you make an award in Sizulu, then judges won't understand it because they speak English. Then it means your judiciary is not transformed. That's why we have a problem then. Then appoint the judges that will understand that award in that language, because I can express my dispute better in my own language. If now I'm presenting in English, it's actually doing as soon as possible, but anyway. Let's proceed, Chairperson. You see, Chairperson, when we're talking caseload, CCMA has almost 200,000 cases, about 190-something thousand cases. The minimum wage is drowning us in terms of the number of cases. I think we've discussed it in this house. Even the predictions that we have, we are far, it's double the number. That tells you that our people are saying that we are not being paid the minimum wage. I'm telling you now. And there are others who don't even know, Chairperson. And I'll make a test. This is what I do, Chairperson, is that you walk into a restaurant, whoever is serving you, ask them what they earn. Let alone ask them whether they know about the national minimum wage. There's two answers possibly going to get. Yes, I know about it, but my employer is refusing. If I raise them, I'm going to be dismissed. And the answers will tell you that I don't know it exists. What is that? But when the national minimum wage was created, it was created for them. The 6 million people that we need to reach were not even there yet, not even a fraction. So when you created this national minimum wage, for the purpose for which it was intended, if you don't reach that 6 million that they're supposed to get, why are we having it? It's called enforcement, also an advocacy. And there's a new movement now that has started claiming discrimination, that why is there 11 rand, 15 rand, 18 rand, and 20 rand with the minimum wage? It should be 20 rand for everybody. Why the distinction? It's a serious movement. I just learned of it 2 weeks ago. They're calling that there should be equity and equality when it comes to minimum wage. What makes others better than us in earning 15 rand? Domestic workers, there's even further complication there. But that's okay. But Chairperson, if you look at the caseload of the CCMA, don't make a mistake to think that's the representation of cases that are running. It's not. You've got bargaining counters and statutory counters and all of those. They're not part of that statistic. Here's the submission. Thousands of cases does not represent success. It represents that there's a problem in the society. Because you've got 200,000 people who are aggrieved. That excludes cases from the bargaining council. That excludes cases in the labor court. Have we taken time to wonder how many cases are pending at the labor court subject to a review whose awards have not been executed? Why are we not asking that? Because it's not applicants, it's not employees, it's people whose issues have not been resolved. And they remain unemployed if it's unfair dismissal matters. That's okay, see? But it's not okay. There's a function we do, discretionary function we do, Chairperson, called job saving. We always present to the portfolio committee that we've saved these thousands of jobs, we've saved thousands of jobs. It's a discretionary thing. We don't have to do it, but we have to do it. And the reason is very simple, Chairperson. There's something we call the triple crisis: unemployment, poverty, and inequality. Inequality is dealt with the employment equity I spoke about. But if you're unemployed, then you're suffering two things: poverty and unemployment. So if there's people facing retrenchment, and let me clarify, Chairperson, these large-scale dismissals we're talking about, that I'm talking about, it's only the large-scale dismissals that comes to us. Only the large-scale ones, in terms of Section 189, capital letter A. But there's others of Section 189 that are happening that are below the radar that we do not know about. So when we give statistics of those that are facing retrenchment, it's only 189A, not others. The numbers are more than that. That's why we then engage and have a partnership with the productivity SA, because they're responsible for the turnaround solution, so we work in partnership to save jobs. That's primary. Let me explain an important principle, Chairperson, which sometimes people underestimate. When you lose one job, it's not one job lost, it's the income of a family lost. And all other dependencies on that salary. You see, I always use this supposition, Chairperson, that if all of us here receiving salaries, just imagine how much depends on that salary. Your school, car, house, school fees, grocery, insurances, and everything else. So if you lose that job, everything else that I just mentioned collapses with it. And which country or a person can survive without a medical aid? You die because you don't get the best medical care. But therefore, you see, that's why they call the retrenchment a faultless dismissal. Maruk's salary remains a dismissal. Maybe you're not your fault. As we're sitting here, we open your computer, you switch it on, you find notice, section 189.3, you are likely to be dismissed due to operational requirements. It's not your choice, you're gone. This is the function we're trying to do so that we prevent that. So we do that with the productivity side, which is very important. That's why we even have a formal agreement to make sure that we do that. Jefferson, I won't waste time on issues relating to Fourth Industrial Revolution and its contribution into the job-saving problem. Because the real issue here, you see, Jefferson, sometimes as people are slalling, you know, we don't listen. I always ask my commissioners this question. What is the foundation of the Labor Relations Act? Why does it exist? What is it that, what is it, why it was done? If there's any one line to my mentors, what is the essence of the Labor Relations Act? Because the Constitutional Court has spoken about that. And interestingly, Chairperson, you'll be taking interest in which case actually did that. It's the University of Cape Town versus Nehau case. It's a Constitutional Court judgment. The judges said the foundation of the Labor Relations Act is job security. So how much of that are we doing, especially with regards to the issue of job saving I'm talking about, the pursuit of that? It's section 185 of the LRA, section 188, read together with section 186, right? Because you have to have job security. That's the foundation of the LRA. That's what the Concord said. If the Concord speaks, no one else can speak. That's what you're supposed to do. So the bottom line of what I'm saying, Jefferson, we have to then start to close the leak, because you see, the debate about issues of jobs, the factors are multitude. Economic growth issues, the 4IR issue. The 4IR issue, Jefferson, is not a possibility, it's a reality. If you look at the banks' retrenchment processes and others, you'll see at the center of that is automation and digitalization is part of the 4IR. But that's okay. Jefferson, having spoken about that Nehau judgment, one of the things that we have developed to deal with this issue is what we call the Return to Work Index. The best award you can make is an award that says you're returning to work because the dismissal was unfair. You see, the problem with just compensation, Chairperson, because it's not contributing into that. If somebody has been unfairly dismissed, not only is it a constitutional infringement, it's an infringement of the LRA. If it is substantively unfair, then the worker must go back to work. Why give them money? You see, the problem with compensation, Chairperson, is that at the time somebody receives money, they are hungry and highly indebted. Within a few days, whatever you give them is gone, but they remain unemployed. That contributes to the unemployment we're talking about. The 29% is not 20%, it's much bigger than that. Having said so, Chairperson, therefore, our view is that the return to work is important. That's why the Labor Relations Act, in terms of Section 193, creates two things, reinstatement and reemployment. Both of them are return to work principles. It's an important submission I want to make. Oh, Chairperson is showing me time. Let me just rush, Chairperson, and finish. I must select what I need to talk about. Now, yeah, there's others, but I'll just... How much time do I have, Chairperson?
For your brain.
I apologize, Jefferson.
Thank you.
All right. Jefferson, there's a problem pending on the national minimum wage. You see, when national minimum wage was legislated, I was telling one of young commissioners of mentoring there and said to him, is the National Minimum Wage Act subject to review? Section 145. The answer is yes. What do I mean? What I mean is that if we make an award, say was just urging the department issues a compliance order, they bring it to us because the employer is not compliant, and say I issue an award to the CCMA. Or we make a decision based on the submission of the work, I'm being paid 19 rand. Can you make an award for the employer to pay me 20 rand? We make an award that says 20 rand. And the employer says, no, I don't like your decision, I'm reviewing it. That means it goes to the labor court. But let me tell you a story about the labor court, Chairperson, briefly. The labor court is sitting with a serious backlog because of the shortage of judges. And if you review a case today, in all likelihood, it will be set down in 3 years' time. Now, here's the question I want to ask about this without deliberating too much on it. You see, there's a famous case, Yagas Dumo. It took 7 years for that case to be completed. We issued an award in 14 days, but it went to the labor court, it went to the labor appeal court, it went to the Concord. 7 years. And the person you're talking about is a security guard who just searched people badly, dismissed, but waited 7 years, a decade, on an award we issued 7 years prior. What happened to him in that 7 years? So if we're talking about an expeditious resolution of dispute, where's expedition if it takes 10 years? There's a Metropath case that ran for almost 10 years. And if you look at the content of what has been argued, it's not about the unfairness or otherwise of the dismissal. It was technical objections, whether the award is prescribed or not, but it takes 10 years to resolve that. But the worker is still outside, unemployed, destroyed. And I can confirm to you, some of them die waiting for that award to be done. Some are going to pension while waiting for the finality of the matter. So when we're talking about that, the award that we issue is final and binding. Gandhi Shuktin, what does it mean if it takes that long? We know that the Concord is the final arbiter. We know that there's remedies in law, you can go to the LIC. But when you, if the legislator did that, is that what we had in mind? And it gets out of hand. So, why then subject a minimum wage to a review? Why is not immune from review? Because the debate is simple, Chairperson. It's about whether you pay 20 rand or not. There is no other debate. So if you don't agree with it, why are we going to the labor court to determine that? What is my view? I'm giving up my paper now. My view is that there's an Australian approach that says create an internal appeal system on such matters. It doesn't have to go to the labor court. You don't like what the commissioner is saying? We'll give you 3 senior commissioners in 10 days. Determine that. Determine, final. That's it. There's no other process beyond that. Clock. Justice is achieved. That's what we call social justice. You can't wait 3 years to be paid 150 rand. Why? By the time you do that, he's dead. Now, there's the biggest problem. We do not implement change policy on constitutional court judgments. Victories at court is not for the parties, but it creates new law. In law, that's what we call the judicial law-making powers of the courts. I'll give a good example. When a Twasa at Gibbs Ground, Obefunugo Twasa, doing a traditional healing, and because of all of that, decided to apply for leave, refused. What is that? What is Utwasa? What spirit are you talking about? Amo Utwasa le, la Utwasa go na hala. And eventually she took leave and got dismissed. After being dismissed, took the CCMA, we awarded in favor. They challenged the labor court. They challenged the LSC. It went to constitutional court. And at the constitutional court, this is what the Concord said. There's no one who has the right to question the logic of any culture and custom. That's what the Concord said. And that's section 3031 of our constitution. And said you can't do that. Therefore, this employee must be reinstated. Now, since that victory, how many workplace policies have been amended to accommodate that? Why is it that the Basic Conditions of Employment Act has not amended to accommodate that? Because that's what the Concord said. So many folks to us, I can't do that because there's no policy, but the Concord said I can. It It's not the only victory. There's a number of them where the court has made decisions on such principles, but it doesn't go full circle for it to influence how we conduct and the policies that we have. And the worst offense is when people come to the CCMN courts to argue the same point that has been resolved by the Concord. Chairperson, I sit in the interviews for commissioners, and I have had the privilege of having some who applied to be commissioners who declared that Mina Nisangu will employ me. And I said, by all means, we'll accommodate you. Now, whether it was a latent paper during the process, that's a different debate, and all of those things. That's a different debate. But, Chairperson, let me close, because I have not done with everything else, but just last point. There's a lot of points I wanted to raise, because you said the workshop, Chairperson, and I'm following your instruction. I'm following your instruction. I'm unleashed on that. Now, but here's an issue. There's a budget there. Chairperson, I'm worried about... We have accepted the fact that we have fiscal pressure. I've accepted that. And we have been told also at the CCM that we are going to suffer the same fate, that our budget will be going to be cut. And that's grievous. We are barely surviving with the minimum wage, legal load and everything else. But here's my question. So, if therefore you don't have resources like we won't have, what do we do with the cases? Because it's okay for us to cut the budget, then we're balancing our books. But that goes right at the heart of saving the memory. Are we striking the balance? Because that's what we're struggling with. The last thing that you want, because I don't want to come when you're now wearing a cap of portfolio committee like we said yesterday. So, Mr. Murajana, how did you exceed your budget? Because my answer would be, I had 200,000 cases. I did not turn them away. I did those cases. I exceeded my budget. Because money is not there and is taken away. How do we balance that? Because this is the plan now, to cut down on work so I can meet the budgetary requirements. Because that goes to the heart of it. I close, Chairperson. The rest we'll discuss at some point. Thank you. Thank you. Sorry, Chairperson, for sticking to the time.
Yeah. No, it's fine. Tebogo, stop looking at me. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Morajane, for the presentation. Before we take question, request the Honourable Member to introduce himself. We know each other. But for the...
Michael Bagram, I apologize for being late, so I'm sorry about that. It was beyond my control, but I do apologize.
Are you going to lead chair or you let them start? Okay. Mr. Bagram?
For my sins for being late, and thank you for that presentation. I appreciate it. I've got a lot to say, but I won't because we haven't got much time. But I do want to just start off where you ended off with the financial constraints, and that's a real problem I'm experiencing it in terms of a user of the CCMA. I'm a regular user of the CCMA. Despite their financial constraints, your commissioners are doing a fantastic job. I know that some of them are running 3 arbitrations a day, which is almost an impossible task. But I did want to add in just something small. You introduced, I think when you started, conciliations telephonically. And it saved a lot of time, trouble, and money. There must be better and stronger ways of using that more effectively. I've been at the behest of a conciliation telephonically, where we were able to settle the dispute over 3 telephone calls, and no one actually travelled in at all. But I know some of the commissioners are saying, can we try and settle this by WhatsApp? Can we try and settle this by email? Can we find better ways of doing this? And it will save a lot of money. And I don't know if you've got people looking into that, and maybe some sort of inquiry into How can we use electronics for the Industrial Revolution to settle our disputes, which will save a lot of money? Leading on from that, I know that the national minimum wage has added to your caseload probably another 30,000, 40,000 cases, from what my own experience. I've been around, as you know, I went on a sightseeing tour of all your CCMAs the end of last year, after the minimum wage had been introduced. And I know that the workload has increased everywhere. I spoke to all your administration staff who told me that they don't have lunch hour, they don't have tea time, they don't, and they deserve an accolade, that's for sure. But I actually think that the claims for financial results, in other words, I wasn't paid my leave pay, or I was underpaid this month my salary, those claims are actually even bigger in numbers than the national minimum wage claims. And maybe you could comment on that, because I think what's happened is those claims always used to go to the department directly. The department has now not got those claims at all. And there are hundreds of thousands of those claims. It's been moved directly onto the CCMA. And there should be an argument with the DG, who now doesn't need all that staff that didn't do all that work anyway at the department, and it's now all moved to you. And is there a way in which you could get the DG to funnel some of that money to the CCMA, because they don't need all those people that had all those complaints. By the way, those complaints were never settled at the department. They were useless, but they are being settled at the CCMA. So it's something that needs to be commented on. Just in terms, you did mention, and I won't take too long, but you mentioned the Kylie case, the sex worker. I disagree with you. She, in fact, was an employee because she earned under the threshold. Anyway, at the time, if you speak, and being a definition, because she'd worked for more than 3 months and she earned under the threshold, except at that stage when the case was heard, there wasn't the 3 months and the threshold. Now we're seeing a lot of what happens if I want to employ a hitman, and I say to him, you have to kill these three people, I'll pay you 10,000 rand a month, and you need to do that. He's still an employee and he's still a worker by definition, and some of the commissioners aren't that happy about facing cases of that nature. I'm using that as a terrible example, but you can see what's happening with some of your commissioners. The other thing is, you mentioned reviews. Now, I'm one of the culprits. Yes, I take cases on review. I have about 30 or 40 outstanding. And yes, it does take 3 years. And you bog it down. And your idea about an internal appeal from an arbitration or something would probably be a good one. I know it's working in Canada, and that's probably where you saw it in action. I saw it in action in Canada as well. But you can never outlaw a review. But what you can do is you can kick for touch. In other words, you can say to Michael Vagram, forget about it. You don't have a right to review until you've heard the internal appeal, which would then take the wind out of my sails. And I like the idea, and if the quicker you could... You don't need legislation for that. You can change your rules. And you don't need us. You don't need Parliament to do that. You can change your internal rules and do it. That's just my legal opinion. You better speak to your lawyers about it. But I don't think you need to change the law at all. In terms of language, it's a fraught issue, because there's got to be a lingua franca. And there is in every country in the world. In other words, one language, which is the language of justice, because of the problems about reviews, etc., etc. So if we choose Zulu as being the language, the lingua franca, then that's fine. I have no problem with that. I'd have to get a translator for myself. But the problem is, and you have this in particular in countries around the world, Canada's got the problem, where half their population speak French and half speak English. And they chose the lingua franca as English, because of the problems, because of textbooks and courts and you name it. I can keep you up half an hour that if you have these cases heard. I understand that when you've got parties who need a translator, it would be better if you had a Khoza-speaking arbitrator with a Khoza-speaking litigant. Obviously it makes more sense, and it obviously will get to justice quickly, and you'll probably get a true justice as opposed to people talking past each other. But I think the actual award is going to have to be written in one language that is chosen in the country. Otherwise, you're going to have a Tower of Babel situation where all of us will be talking, but no one will be understanding at all. And that'll create a problem. Just another thing about that argument about the national minimum wage, that there should be one national minimum wage, in other words, the 20 rand. There's an argument now as to how much it's going up. I think people are talking past each other there, but we'll wait for the minister to release the report. We'll start nagging him for that report that was handed to him a few weeks back. But you understand that the commission that's investigating this has had a look at it very carefully. From what I understand, and I don't know yet because it's all rumour, but they've invested, the experts are saying that we lost almost 50,000 domestic jobs on the introduction of the minimum wage. It was almost immediately, I think over time it's 500,000 domestic jobs we've lost. Even at the 15 rand, we've lost it. So it's a way up. I know the debate and I understand it, but it's a way up. It doesn't affect me, but I can promise you it affects the domestics. In other words, if you suddenly took it to 20 rand, we'd lose another 500,000. And we just add to the queue. The Treasury told us that we were going to lose 750,000 jobs, but we've lost more than that. And then just lastly, and I've got lots of other things, but lastly in terms of retrenchment, you say the small-scale retrenchment never gets reported to you. Of course it doesn't. But I must tell you, my anecdotal feeling is that the small-scale retrenchments are much higher in numbers than the large-scale retrenchments. And it's horrific because they're the people that are going to create jobs in South Africa. Small business, not big business. Big business has got jobless growth and they're shrinking. It's small business that we need to rely on. And somehow none of us are doing anything to help that small business, because all of us, and when I say all of us, I think all of us sitting on this committee know that there's retrenchments across the board, across the country, and we don't know what the numbers are, because we'll never know. I know that I get phone calls for retrenchments every day. At least five businesses phone me every day, 5 days a week, to say they need to retrench their staff, even if they're employing four people. They've then got to retrench two or whatever. Those numbers must be horrific. And somehow none of us know about it. You know that the numbers are increasing for big business. And you're doing a good job, because your commissioners are intervening on 189A, and they are trying to save jobs. But I think it's a drop in the ocean. So thank you, Mr. Chairman, for allowing me.
Thank you. Chair?
As I was listening to you, what came to my mind is that I was then beginning to look around and say, okay, we've got three legal forms here that I know, hearing others, but that I know. So sales, director, baker, and I made my chocolate. They are not delivering. Some of us are organic legal foods by virtue of either being a worker or a composite of your mic. Okay. So either of being a worker or being an official of a union or an official of municipality. Work somewhere, we then become. And what came to my mind is that we have laid bare in front of us that we fought. Struggles, and we are victims of those struggles. always remember that Minister of Higher Education, Science and Technology always say the ANC is the victim of its own struggle. And I'm not going to go there. There are three issues which you have posed. This is a workshop, and I would appreciate if we don't then begin to counter what as we were talking. I think the issues that I picked up. There was an employer in the Eastern Cape who kept calling me, only to find out when he was dismissed. There was an award. What he elevated to me at the time when I was in health is that the department is not, what is your term? It's not implementing, enforcing the award. Until I had to call the MC and say, but what's the problem? I can't sleep. Longun the phone like the Vuswa phone at 6 AM, the Lala phone yard. He said, no, you shall, because he knows there has been a negotiation with him. He knows why he was dismissed and why given that. And when he called me back, I said that I don't deal with people that are dishonest. You have never reflected to me that you sat with the department through the office of the MEC at a particular time. And you are learned not to know that if the department is refusing to enforce the award, there's labor court. Ordinary general assistant knows that. And that's the last time that I get out of my shoulders. There was. I'm seated here, as we said yesterday, that employers are running away with murder. We are seated here as politicians. The only thing that we know, we politic, we a blame game, when in fact we have got challenges for you. Serious, serious challenges. If I was an ordinary South African seated somewhere and listen to what you have been saying, there's no party here that can be confident and say, now we're doing better than the governing party. All of us. Because we are either part of the bigger scheme of the employer, either being a farmer or he's in that space. And we know for a fact that they are, but the challenge is that we are forever arguing and trying to reflect who argues better than. And the award does not need any Marxism. No. And the award. Because if you then refuse, but in fact, maybe I'm wrong, because it's part of the, what is it that they call it in communist language and debates, that it has just slipped my mind. Because if you refuse, you are refusing because what is important to you is that you are going to lose money. That's simple logic to me. I'm not a lawyer. You are refusing because you don't want to. You are refusing because you don't want to reinstate this person, because if he's gone, he's gone. At least you know that you are going to save 10,000 rand every month. We are complaining, maybe at this committee, we must elevate this thing, because it's only in health Because health is an emotive issue, but the shortage of staff. This is also a challenge, because if the issue, in my view, of caseloads, that cases that take 10 years because shortage of judges in the labor court, then something is to be done. And I do think that when we sit as the committee at a particular time, we must take, because at the end, this committee is expected to assist and create an enabling environment that the people are employed. But on the other hand, employers are retrenching. On the other hand, institutions that are supposed to protect these people, there is a problem. So I really picked up these two. For me, that in all what you have said, we can speak high-powered language here, I don't have a problem with that, but as I am seated here in my constituency, in Woodford, Nelson Mandela, I know for a fact that there are people that have perished. All of us know that there are people, Black African people in particular, poor, have perished because the employer has refused to enforce the award that has been given. And if it says it's final and binding, why is it that we allow? And I think as legislators, we must take that blame, that we are a bit soft. Maybe it's because we are to be diplomatic, I don't know. But our people have fought. There are people that have perished for you, perished because they fought to ensure that there is Labor Relations Act, fought and perished, killed by the system. And you know, what Bishop Mbete, there are people that died without having a RDP house. There are people that died without taking their children to the school of their choice or to work where they want to work. There are people that died having not being able to apply for a grant for me and you to be able to take our children to the people to the school of our choice to where we. So I'm saying these, and you have raised something in me sitting down, you have raised something very important, that we maybe, should I say, maybe because of the volume of the work, or being ignorant, or taking things for granted, that when there's a problem, we don't pick that up and ensure that how then do we ensure that this is then amended for people. And what I've observed as an activist, because we have been told that this is an activist, we are all activists in different ways. Mere fact that we're here, we don't the only thing that we are good at is talking and arguing. So I think as a committee, the two important things that we will have to sit down at an appropriate time with the department, and yourself coming back, because in this, if you can just, if it's possible, through you, say, if it's possible that the CCMA just give us, because we can't be general now, because we are to give us which sector has got more, and so that when in terms of the labor court, we will have to go to and sit with the justice, department and trying to understand what is the situation. But we will have to, because the enforcement are correct. Why should there be enforcement when people are not to do what they are doing? When the award is there, it's simple class. It's an award. You have raised a number of things, culture. I disagree with what Mr. Brigham has said. It's true. If in education there is a debate that maths is to be taught, children are to be taught. One educator said in one in another commission that we say people, these children are passing whatever, but they are taught in English, whereas at home they speak Xhosa. So it can't be that now we must, it's only because it's a universal language. If there is a pilot that is to be done, that is to be done. Science and technology had innovation centers, and those centers, one of them, it was in PE. I attended when I was in science and technology. And you know where it was in PE? It was right in Summerstrand. And I said, you want to empower people. That's why you are all males here and white, old. It's because you have science and technology has been said to be a language, a subject of rich males in particular, white. That's why you are bringing it in Summerstrand. Why don't you take it in, you had a center in Zwide, or you had a center which is going to be at Nangoza Chechebe, which is Centenary Hall, where everybody in the location, if you want to empower, and I said, I charge you. And I met one of them who greeted me, who I said, do you still remember me? He said, no, he said, I want to tell you that. In our entity, we had you. So I agree with you that some of them, there must be special action, even if there is a pilot, because good people, our people are perishing right underneath our nose. And the unfortunate part, a party that is taking the knock, it is the party that ensures that people are liberated, have got rights, which are enshrined in the Constitution, and which then gave birth to all this. They are perishing. So I just wanted to, it's the this presentation, via my apology, and the one by the non-causes, because I find this I'm a bit emotive, and the reason that I'm emotional, good people, is because I've been a worker. I have been a worker, and I didn't start working by being a nurse. My very first work, I was a packer at OK Bazaar, first by when females, we were working 4 hours. And in that 4 hours, you were to stand. You can go to the loo. If you are menstruating, you will stand there until your pad is soaked, because you are told, when you ask to go and change your sanitary towel, you are told that it's 4 hours. And I left. I went to Livingston Hospital. I asked, how far is my application, because I have applied. So I'm saying some of these things are things even in the health sector at a particular time. I was supervised by a system at the time, both. And the Nationalist Party was clear. Huh? It was clear that you toe the line, or, and that's why we joined unions. Union reforms, that's why they were the CCMA and whatever. So I think this workshop, as I've said, fine, what is this? Labor is about law, But it's about law within the context of ensuring that we change the social conditions of our people. All of us seated here, we've got stories. Stories that if we, you will say, I go, bold and beautiful, by your actor, like a generation. It's really because it's the point is, which I'm thinking is that, are we really doing enough for our people? Or kukuma. And I want to say it here without being any fear of contradiction over that. I think at some point the ruling party allows it to be politically blackmailed. And when somebody says something, which we it's our struggles in these 25 years. Yes, there are things that are an impediment, are a challenge, but it must be within the context that here in Cape Town, here across the, walking in this, passing this gate, has not been getting an award. It has never been enforced. And we're here. So I it took long, I agree, but maybe it's a presentation that we must think, but calling other departments that are key in ensuring that they assist, and in particular the primary one is justice. Thank you.
Any other comments, questions?
Chair, thank you very much, and I welcome this presentation. I'll just go straight to the question that I'm having. One of the issues that you clearly indicated was to ask the commissioner that you are mentoring. What is the primary mandate of the Labour Relations Act? And eloquently you said that it's job security. My question is, currently South Africa is confronted by the ever-increasing unemployment rate. Does that mean the Labour Relations Act fails to secure the jobs? Because my understanding is that whenever there is any law, any legislation that is passed for the purpose. But is it purpose being met that it secures the jobs? Because every day the jobs are being shed, there is no security. And yet we have the Labour Relations Act. The other one that is very emotional with me is the failure of the parties to execute the awards that have been given. And it is very true that for a very long time people even end up falling on their way without getting their cases reviewed, reconciled and everything, because the process is very long. My question is, are there other remedial actions that you award this in order to assist the employer who has been exploited or victimized, but there is a failure to comply? What is it that we are doing? Because if you are going to say that up until to the Constitutional Court is very expensive. And we may talk all about the social justice that everyone is free, everyone is equal in front of the law. It is not. It depends. How much financial stamina do you have that you can go up until the Constitutional Court? Now, we are having these entities like the CCMA. What is it that they are doing, saying that somebody is being exploited but cannot sustain himself or herself up until to the Constitutional Court? What is it that can be done? The last thing that I want to check, fortunately, this is the Department of Labor Relations. this Department of Labor and Employment, what is it that this department can do to stand on the side of the employees more than any other thing, so that they enjoy the benefits of the rights that we have read us, which they have to definitely get? Because I'm referring to the issue of a Lily Mine, where three employees up until today are still buried underground since 2016 February. And the Department of Labor, including of Energy, has interdicted the families not to retrieve the bodies underground. One of the advanced reasons that the retrieval is very expensive. What is it that can be done? Because we can't be a Department of Labor and Employment and yet we fail to secure the security of the employees and to secure their rights. But we have all the legislation. Let me say this, colleagues. In South Africa, there is sufficient laws. There is sufficient policies. The only thing that is a problem with South Africa is the execution of those policies. You can read whatever confrontation, whatever problem that we're having. It has got a solution because we have the Constitution. But the failure is the execution. A classical example is what you have just said, that the award is given, but it will take for 10 years for that award to be implemented. But what has happened to that person? I can attest to, and so has everybody, that the many people that are being exploited with this long journey of getting their issues resolved, others end up having their house confiscated. They lose their house. They divorce. People die. All simply related to the person that has lost his job. What is it that expeditiously can be done in order to curtail that suffering so that people can immediately get the award executed so that these problems we are dealing with and talking about are stopped? Thanks.
Thank you. Honorable Mem.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I think let's appreciate first the presentation and the points raised. I thought maybe, in addition to what has been raised by my colleague next to me, I think maybe it would be more helpful if the department can sort of come up with concrete proposals on how this challenge, particularly that relates to the periods where disputes are prolonged. Like, for instance, the question would be, is it to the benefit of the aggrieved worker when an award has been made at the CCMA for such an award to be delayed, say, for 30 days before you can approach the court to ask for enforcement of the award? Should the period not be reviewed such that you place an obligation more on the parties to seek to resolve the problems much more earlier on? Like, you'd find that in many instances that you'd find workers would go away believing that there is an award and I'm reinstated or I'm about to be compensated, only to find that after 30 days that no, there's a review. And when you go and check the date, the submission for the intention for the review, it was made maybe 29 days after the award that was made, or even on the final day, on the 30th. Yeah. So I think that's the question that perhaps more than us in Parliament, I think that the department itself should in fact help us to resolve that problem. That problem. Yeah. Equally on the issue of the culture, because I think the laws allow us. It's not a question of either or, whether we should go for Xhosa or Tswana or Pedi translations. The law is there. Yeah.
the department must be creative enough to come up with concrete proposal. The point that I wanted to check on is with regard to the points that were raised earlier on with regard to the constitution. Yeah, I'm not a constitutional expert, say, but I don't think the presentation is correct, because the constitution should not be read one line out of the whole document. It's the totality of the document. The preamble represents the totality of the document, because in the constitution you have citizens, because the constitution defines the citizens. So it's quite strange that we can be at a loss when we're talking about the preamble. I think that point should at least be taken away, that kind of interpretation. Yeah. The second one is with regard to the issue of the illegal foreigners. I think the point that is made that we need to defend them, I think that one is an international practice, because you don't, by virtue of having them as illegal foreigners, have a right to abuse them, because you're breaking the law, as the department is correctly pointing out. But however, I think the point that we need to, perhaps so that we also act preemptively, is the extent to which both as a department and on our side we cooperate to ensure that we reduce the instances where in fact illegal foreigners are used as a replacement of labor inside the country, because there is that widespread practice, particularly in the Western Cape, particularly in Limpopo, particularly in Mpumalanga, in farms and other areas where you find this practice, which is rife. So the key question would again be whether, for instance, is it not going to be helpful for us to begin to move with speed to deal with that problem, so that even the illegal foreigners are in fact where they have spent appropriate time that requires them to in fact qualify for a minimum rights, so that they are assisted, so that they do not become abused by employers. But the most important part is when they displace workers, South Africans, where in fact South African workers are unable to get the jobs, and then the illegal foreigners are in fact used in that regard. So my point, therefore, Chair, is whether, for instance, the department can it come up with concrete proposals on that. That would be my proposal rather than a question. Then the last point is with regard to the national minimum wage. I think the point here is more around exemption than the review. I think the exemption, because the parties to that are covered by the national minimum wage are in fact allowed to apply for exemption. Maybe the question we need to examine more thoroughly is whether, for instance, should we not, in line with the question of the hours that have been made, where you have a much more lengthy period that allows for review, whether we should not in fact tighten up that process, so that the reviewers are not used, application for exemptions are not used to frustrate rather than to assist the parties, so that where the parties are unable to comply, there is a genuine and meaningful process that within reasonable time you'd find that parties are able then to work together and ensure that the exemption is not to the detriment of the parties that are supposed to benefit from whatever the determination is. I'm just reminded of my own experience, for instance, in local government. Local government for a long time didn't have a minimum wage, and it was quite an uphill battle to have a national minimum wage. And at the time when finally we agreed, this issue of exemption was in fact a practice that we put in place
and allowed various local municipalities to then phase in to the national minimum wage. Initially, you had three bands that talk about small municipalities, medium municipalities, and big municipalities. But today, you have a single band. Because over a period, you allow the parties to move and then set up acceptable timelines that would allow them to phase in and then meet the required national minimum wage. The point, therefore, is how then do we use that kind of experience and many other experiences so that the exemptions are not necessarily used as a weapon to attack and to undermine the intention of the national minimum wage, but rather to reinforce it and make it a meaningful tool to lift the sectors that are currently being assisted, so that they are able, therefore, to comply with the acceptable minimum standards in terms of wage rates and so on. So that would be my points, Chair. Yeah. Thank you.
Oh, no, I don't think we have other issues. May I guide the responses, because the bulk of what has been said is really comments. And most of the comments that are made to the department, for the department to take, look back, and maybe in the future come back with solutions. I'm trying to avoid a situation where we comment on a comment, because we might... sit here, and I'm just going to run through these issues. I'll give Mr. Morajane an opportunity to respond, but may I ask you that around issues of particularly enforcement, and I'm excluding awards, but the other issues of enforcement, issues that used to be with the department and so forth, we have asked Sam at the end to just do a wrap-up, and part of that wrap-up is to deal with issues that have been raised by the committee of entities operating in silos and the contradictions and, and so forth, or overlaps. And so those issues Sam is going to cover. The two things that I would like you perhaps to respond to, one is the issue, I don't know to what extent you're able to take this forward, but what is the CMA doing to improve things? And two issues have been raised. One, Mr. Bagram raised the issue of budget and teleconciliations, but there seems to be a sticky issue around reviews and appeal. The chairperson has made a suggestion that maybe we need to bring the other departments, justice being one of them, to say we have an issue in terms of the time it takes to finalize a matter. There was a very specific question: is the Labor Relations Act failing us in terms of its mandate? So, just in brief, if you could just respond to that. Again, I would ask you not to deal with the issue of Lily Mine. Perhaps the department, send when you close, if you want to touch on it. Because I don't think you'd have direct knowledge on it, unless you do. The issue of foreigners was dealt with extensively yesterday, and the issue again is to ask the department to look at how best you regulate that. So I take it that there can't be an on-spot answer. Otherwise, we're going to have personal suggestions being thrown around. So those are the issues. So that just the two issues, Mr. Morajan, if you can respond to. The other issues, I'll ask Sam when you do the summary at the end to deal with. Thank you.
Yeah, there's a very interesting question I would have loved to deal with, but I'll stick to the ones you've mentioned, because others I think needed just a clarity. Just a quick one on the review and exemption. I think we must distinguish them. It is correct that the national minimum wage employers are allowed to apply for exemption, which is dealt with. There's a process to that. If granted, then exempted, then 12 months, there's a review of whether their financial position is still the same. My point was not much about the exemption. It was about if a worker comes to the 5th of May because they're not paid in minimum wage, and then there's a debate, and eventually the commissioner makes a decision, he then makes an award. The concern is if you are not happy with that award, specifically on minimum wage, not for exemption, exemption is a different process, that you can't challenge that and take it to the labor court because it's going to take them 3 years. That you must have an internal review system that allows an expeditious resolution of that, because it's a factual dispute than a legal dispute. It's either you paid 20 million or you didn't. That can be resolved internally. So that's a different process in terms of Section 145. So that's, I thought I'd just clarify that, that's what I meant. And the exemption is an application, financial statement, people do that. But we must then be able to reconcile the two. Just a quick clarification of that. And then on the issue of telecom, that system works like a jam. I think members can also note that the CCMA has now introduced an app. We've launched an app, and we've received very good reviews about the app in terms of checking your case status and things like that. The plan is to expand the content of that app, because like you correctly said, minimum wage disputes are factual disputes. And in fact, you don't even need a commissioner to resolve that. It's about, did you pay 20 million or you didn't? But we have now planning to expand that app so that it can create space for us to be able to even have, to a certain extent, because it's not just the app, we also have a website, in our website, where you can do exactly the same thing. But we want to find a legal compliant way to run the process without flouting our rules, and be able to expedite, in an expedited way, deal with those disputes. And social media is one of those. You remember in the just a judgment that you can actually resign by sending a WhatsApp. You can accept an offer of a contract through a WhatsApp and it becomes a contract. It doesn't have to be in it's written, but you're using social media. So I've tasked our ICT to find a way that is as speedy and as effective as a teleconference. For those who don't know, it's when the commissioner parties don't come to the CCMA, we phone the parties, and then we try to resolve the matter through the telephone. And it has been very successful, because parties don't spend money, there's no, all of that, so it's very quick. So we are exploring that. The problem we have is the solutions that we have to expand that is budget, because most of those things need budget for us to be able to expand our ICT environment to be able to do that. So we will welcome the proposals there in as far as that issue is concerned. The reviews, other than what I said about the national minimum wage, you can't stop them. You can't stop them. But the Australian and the Canadian approach of internal appeal systems is a way to look at. But that really will... What we're afraid to do through the rules, like you said, we've tried in the past. We were found to be ultra-virus in doing things that are not provided for in the Act. If there's to be any interpretation that can allow us to do so, we will use it. Maybe we should test the ground and do so, because the idea is just to do it as speedily and in the most inexpensive way possible, and so that we can be able to do so. There's other questions that you've raised that I'm unable to... I must limit myself to this one. Is the LRA failing us? No, the LRA is not failing us. It's the people who are executing it that are failing us also. The LRA works. If it has not been of the LRA, I can't imagine what would have happened to all these 200,000 cases. CCMA, when it started, we started with 64,000 cases when we opened doors in 1996. We're now sitting on almost 200,000 in 2020. And there's been a lot of victories as a result of the LRA. But it is the behavior also of parties that is a problem, because the legal framework is there. People have used, you see, the amendment of 2015 created that you must give security if you're reviewing an award. That was an attempt to curb reviews, that you must give insecurity that you're going to pay this money that is owed to a worker at the conclusion of the process. But members, I can tell you this for a fact, and I think Mr. Bagrim will agree on this for those who are practicing, is that there are many reviews that are done purely for stalling the process, not because there's an issue with the award, just purely to delay it. They file a review and they leave it there. It sits and rots and nothing happens. And workers who are not even, especially those that have no union rep, have no lawyers, they just sit and wait for something to happen. Nothing will happen. When they go and present the award, they said, no, we're reviewing you, go away. And it ends there. I did go to organized labor and I said to them, when you have a member that you represent, the award that is issued, your battle doesn't end there. If it's being reviewed, you walk with the worker until the end, even if it's up to the Comm Court. Because we have a responsibility to do so. Membership doesn't end when you issue an award. It must run until you... And in every stage of the process, you must explain to him what is going on. I'll give a bad example, which is a good example. You see, conciliation at Parliament Councils and CCMA, which is in the context of review, expect both parties to be present for it to be effective. I just want to answer the effectiveness of the LRA. If parties come and meaningfully consult and resolve matters at conciliation, then the LRA is working, and we've done so more than 70% of those things. But the problem with where the state is the party to the proceedings, they don't come to the hearings. They don't come to the conciliation. So we can't conciliate. So others who come, they come and tell you that I'm told to come and to just pick up a certificate that says the matter is unresolved. But that's not the purpose of the LRA. The conciliation mediation is meant for you to come and sit down with a mandate and engage with the other party. But if us, the one that makes the laws, are the one that doing exactly the opposite, that's an offense. It can't be correct. And at the moment, the biggest problem, I've raised it, Osegi will tell you, the governing board, this issue of state as an employer and doing that in our processes, even in the bargaining council, it's frustrating the statute. But it can't be the state doing that, because we should act exemplary in executing the very reason why we created the conciliation process. It just can't be correct. Literally, somebody comes out, said in one matter, once this lady came in and said, I'm on study leave, I'm told to come and collect the certificate. And I said, well, go to a place where there's a certificate collection, not a decision man. Here you will get the mandate, I'll wait for you. You will bring the mandate, you will engage meaningfully into the process. But you can't have such things happening. This is not theory, this is reality. So I will not deal with the other questions because I'm tempted to, but...
Yeah, we get the temptation. I'm only going to allow you, Honorable Member.
I take the point of correction, but I just wanted to raise a quick point, a follow-up on the review process. Whether, for instance, the question is not rather about the internal rules of CCMAs, where you talk about the CCM rules on the question of the adjudication of disputes, the point that is raising, because you may find it difficult to get it on the legislation itself, but the parties themselves when amending the rules, so that such that you in fact allow parties where in fact the variation has been made downward, in fact to make an objection, a recourse, and that we always strive to have, because you can't say in principle that you are against a review, because a reviewer can in fact be an upward reviewer, which is to the benefit of the worker. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, Honorable Member. I think the point must just be noted. Ladies and gentlemen, it's 20 past 11. We're going to take a 10-minute tea break. I'm told that tea is served. I'm going to make sure that at 5:30 we are seated and Dr. Nabula starts immediately at 5:30. Thank you.
That we need to be simple, that we need to try and make sure that we provide as much information as possible for the members of the portfolio committee to understand what we do. So I've made slight changes to the presentation, but it's not really changes. I've moved a lot of slides around. But as I talk, I will indicate on your packs what is the slide number that I'm referring to, but the content is as it was. In terms of the subjects that I will cover, I will firstly talk about the mandate of Productivity SA, how it is aligned to the policy mandate of the Department of Employment and Labour, the structure of Productivity SA, our functions and value proposition, the implications of the name change from DOL to DEL, the implications to our day-to-day operations and strategic focus. I'll also talk briefly about the partnerships and collaborations, the challenges that Productivity SA currently has. I'll touch on our performance briefly, the limitations, what's still outstanding, and how can the portfolio committee help us. This is slide 5 on your pack. It talks about the mandate of Productivity SA. Productivity SA is an entity of the Department of Employment and Labour. It's established in terms of Section 31 of the Employment Services Act No. 4 of 2014. As a Schedule 3A entity, our responsibility is to fulfill an economic and social mandate of the government, which is really about promoting employment growth and productivity, thereby contributing to South Africa's socio-economic development and competitiveness. The vision of the entity is to lead and inspire a productive and competitive South Africa. And our mission is to improve productivity by diagnosing, advising, implementing, monitoring, and evaluating solutions that are aimed at promoting South Africa's sustainable growth, development, and employment through increased competitiveness. The overall goal, this slide the members do not have, but it just is about what our overall goal is. Our goal is Productivity SA to aid South Africa to achieve a productive, high-income economy, which is globally competitive, with sustainable growth, full and productive employment, and decent work for all. In terms of how we are aligned or how Productivity SA is aligned to the policy mandate of the Department of Employment and Labour, this is slide 3 on your packs. The mandate of the Department of Employment and Labour is to regulate the labour market through policies and programs which are developed in consultation with social partners. And these are aimed at improved economic efficiency and productivity, creation of decent employment, and I'll only highlight the three that really relate to what Productivity SA does, which is the first, the second, and the last one, which talks to giving value to social dialogue in the formulation of sound and responsive legislation and policies to attain labor market flexibility for competitiveness of enterprises. This slide is slide number 5 on your packs. It talks about the structure of Productivity SA. We are governed by a tripartite board which consists of 7 members that are appointed in terms of Section 33 of the Employment Services Act. The board consists of the chairperson, 6 members, 4 of the members are drawn from NEDLAC, 2 represent organized labor, another 2 represent organized business, and 2 represent government. The entity has an executive committee which comprises of 8 members. The next slide, which is slide 5 on your packs, talks about the footprint of Productivity SA. We operate in 3 regional offices. The first region is the Johannesburg region, which is based in our head office in Midrand, which also services Gauteng, the Northwest, and Limpopo. The second region is the eThekwini region, which is based in Durban and services KZN, the Eastern Cape, and Mpumalanga. The last region is the Cape region, which is based in Bellville, Cape Town, and it services the Western Cape, the Northern Cape, and the Free State. This is slide 6 of your packs, which talks about functions and our value proposition. Our functions really are articulated by the Act, which is Section 32 of the Service Employment Act. The first function is to promote a culture of productivity in the workplace. The second one is to develop relevant productivity competencies to facilitate and evaluate productivity improvement and competitiveness in workplaces, to measure and value productivity in the workplace, to maintain a database of productivity and competitiveness systems, and to publicize those systems, to undertake productivity-related research, and lastly, to support initiatives that are aimed at preventing job losses. All of this, and as I said, I mean, I took them straight from the Act. Our value proposition talks to us being making sure that productivity and competitiveness improvement solutions that enhance the productive capacity and operational efficiency of enterprises throughout their business life cycle, which is meant to accelerate wealth and decent employment creation. In terms of our service offerings, we focus on four of those. The first is on enterprise competitive and sustainability, which we carry out through a program called Value Chain Competitiveness Program. This program deals with small, medium, and micro enterprises, which specifically fall within the productive sectors of the economy, with a focus mainly on the IPAP priority sectors. We also deal with cooperatives and municipalities. So we provide a lot of enterprise development programs to all these small entities. The second focus is on prevention of job losses. This is carried through the Business Turnaround and Recovery Program. We refer to this as the TERS program. And the TERS program, or the Business Recovery and Turnaround and Recovery program, really aims at supporting enterprises that are facing economic distress, and the aim is to save jobs or minimize retrenchment of employees. The third program relates to productivity-related research, which is carried by our research unit. And the aim of this program is really to ensure that they provide productivity and competitiveness-related value-added information and statistics. Also look at best practices and some of benchmarkings that we do with other productivity institutes, but also ensuring that research is current all the time. The last program is really aimed at promoting a culture of productivity in the workplace, but also a culture of productivity across South Africa. But also it's about driving accountability for productivity performance across sectors, which is at the national, at the sector, and enterprise level. The next slide, which talks, it's slide number 2 in your packs. It really talks about the reconfiguration of the Department of Labor to the Department of Employment and Labor. What are the implications thereof on Productivity SA? We look at this move, which includes employment as part, an opportunity or a platform that strategically positions Productivity SA to lead a productivity and competitiveness-driven agenda, and a productivity and competitiveness-driven agenda and development agenda for South Africa. Therefore, our programs or interventions will always ensure that they contribute towards the national development goals, specifically on Chapter 3 of the NDP, which talks about targeting programs that contribute to sustainable and inclusive growth and development. Chapter 9, which talks about developing world-class centers and programs in the national system of innovation, training, and development. And Chapter 13, which is about implementing programs that improve efficiency and effectiveness of the government. Also, our programs or initiatives aim to talk to the sustainable development goals, specifically the SDG 8, which talks to promoting sustained, inclusive and sustainable economic growth, full and productive employment and decent work for all. In terms of, again, our priorities over the medium-term strategic framework 2020 to 25, again, you don't have the slide on your pack. It really still talks to our program, which is enterprise competitiveness and sustainability, job preservation, evidence-based planning, monitoring and evaluation, and productivity, culture and accountability. We believe that if we do that, the outcomes that we will have or the outcomes that the entity will have for South Africa would be enterprise wealth growth or growing the wealth of enterprises, income growth for employees, government revenue growth, workplace transformation, increased competitiveness of the country, and poverty reduction. The next slide talks to partnerships and collaborations, which is slide 15 in your packs. You know, some of the strategic partners, what we do is we choose strategic partners very well, you know, within our sister companies or system departments, but also we look at the private sector and we look at, you know, the institutions of higher learning. So in terms of the government departments in the economic cluster, we have a very close relationship with the Department of Trade and Industry through our Workplace Challenge Program. We also have a very close relationship with the Department of Small Business, which we work collaboratively on the cooperative sector. We also have relationships with USIDA, USCIR, and USCTAS. And really, this is about ensuring that we support SMEs and co-ops within the special economic zones, industrial parks, township and rural economies. We also have relationships with a number of development funding agencies. I've also indicated a relationship with the CCMA and the UIF, with which Mr. Murajana has also referred to. But also on the CCMA, really it's a lot of collaboration, particularly on the implementation of the Presidential Job Summit Framework Agreement, and also initiatives that talk to job retention, including the schemes that talk to, like the layoff schemes, the retraining, and alternative employment opportunities. We have relationships with institutions of higher learning, such as the University of Pretoria, the University of the Western Cape, also research companies, and the CETAs. And a lot of this, we collaborate especially on ensuring that we can provide the country with, you know, latest research on productivity and just making sure that we are at the forefront of getting the latest information. And then also organized labor and some labor relations. We work closely with BUSA, we have relationships with NAFCOX, and really up here it's still around ensuring that we preserve jobs where we can, especially within BUSA, but also we use the organized labor and organized business as a way of you know, promoting that productivity, culture and movement in the country. We also have relationships with like the International Labour Organization, the Japan International Cooperative Agency, especially on programs such as our Kaizen programs, and also, you know, our continuous improvement programs. We also have relationships with a number of other productivity institutes out of the country, especially from a benchmarking perspective, just to ensure that Productivity SA remains in the forefront of productivity information where possible. The next slide, which is slide 8 in your packs, refers to the challenges of Productivity SA. It is slide 8, Chairperson, on your pack.
No, sorry, Chairman. What is confusing me is that you go on page 50, then go back to page 2, you go on page this, and go back to page. So, yeah, pardon me. That's what makes me that take it backwards. But it's okay. I think I've managed to master what you are.
Okay. Apologies. I think what I tried to do, especially after yesterday, was to try and, you know, change the flow so that it all flows together. But unfortunately, your packs were already ready, and that's why I'm trying to refer to your packs. So please, I apologize for that. In terms of the challenges that Productivity SA faces, funding is a big challenge for Productivity SA. I'll try not to dwell on this because, you know, as much as it is a big challenge, reality is that it has been brought to the portfolio committee, and I think discussions are currently underway. However, it is a huge issue for Productivity SA, because reality is, you know, it affects our service delivery. It affects, you know, the way we are able to service the country. Also, in terms of, you know, funding of the core programs, which is the workplace challenge and TES, as much as the DTI funds WPC, that funding sometimes is not always guaranteed, or sometimes it does not come timeously, which somehow affects our planning, and it really affects the way we provide services. The TERS program, which you know, has been funded through the UIF, there have been major challenges along that. In the past 5 years, past 3 years, either the funding does not, you know, come to Productivity SA timelessly, or else it does not come at all. The next slide, which is your slide 9 in your packs, it really talks about some of the challenges that, or the results that emanate from those challenges. Because of the funding, we are unable to deliver on the Productivity SA mandate, with the TES program being suspended since 2017. Secondly, the entity continues to experience persistent financial deficit. Currently, we're sitting at around 14 million deficit, and this does affect, it threatens the going concern of the entity. The other challenge, or the result thereof, is the fact that consistently, or we persist in applying for additional funds or financial assistance from the Department of Labor at an average of about 15 million since 2016. And reality is that if this is not granted, the entity risks liquidation, some form of restructuring, or even retrenchment of employees. Because of the funding challenges, the entity is unable to expand its footprint, and therefore we find that the delivery of services is really limited to you know, a few provinces, as I had mentioned. Because of the funding challenges, again, we are unable to attract the right expertise, and people with skills, you know, resign because of job insecurities, which is a big challenge. Currently, we have a big vacancy rate, which is which emanates from challenges around funding. We have about 19 posts, which are costing us over 15 million in the service delivery programs, which, if are not filled, will somehow prevent Productivity SA to deliver on its mandate equitably across the country. Also, because of the lack of funding, you know, product innovation becomes a problem. We're not able to develop new products or to look at our interventions that will ensure that we deliver well on the country. also, I mean, our ICT and really our tools are outdated, which, whether we like it or not, does affect the way we conduct business. And lastly, in terms of especially marketing or creating awareness, it becomes a bit impossible to build a brand where people know or how to access our services. In terms of some of the history of performance, which is on slide 10 in your packs, I think there was a request that we highlight some of these. Through the workplace challenge, Productivity SA has been able to assist or support about 104 companies, which range from small to medium enterprises, especially in the special economic zones and industrial parks. It's quite interesting because when one looks at the number of 104, it actually looks very small. But when we look at the capacity that we have, but also on the fact that workplace challenge is implemented over a 24-month period, we believe that 104 is a good indicator. This intervention of workplace challenge has resulted in the creation of over 268 jobs and the preservation of over 146,871 existing jobs in the companies that have participated in the program. We also celebrated the 20 years of implementation of the Workplace Challenge program, which in our books is quite an achievement, because through this program over the past 20 years, we have managed to assist a number of entities, a number of enterprises. Also through our enterprise and supply development programs, we have supported 5,588 SMMEs and co-ops, and 194 of these come from the Transnet program, which we have had for the past 5 years. And also, we have trained 217 champions across the country. The next slide, which is slide number 11 on your packs, talks about the launch of the Competitive Enhancement Program, which we did with the KZN Department of Economic Development and Tourism. This program runs for 6 months for emerging exporters and 10 months for large exporters. It really focuses on productivity and innovation, value chain efficiency, and the export market. It targets the manufacturing sector, agriculture and agro-processing companies, and the services industry. We've only run this program for a year, and when we look at the results, it seems to be, you know, bearing fruit, but we're still in negotiations with the Department of Economic and Economic Development in KZN to continue the program. Also, in terms of our performance, we've partnered with the CCMA and BUSA on the development of the web tool. I think Mr. Murajani referred to that earlier. Also, as of the 31st of March 2019, Productivity SA has been able to generate additional revenue of over 10 million as compared to 6 million in 2018. We generate additional revenue from work that we do in the private sector. So we excited that in the year that's just finishing, we've been able to up that to over 10 million. We've had an unqualified audit with 9 findings compared to the 20 findings that we have had in 2017-18. So it is quite an improvement that from 20 to 9, we seem to be making headways in ensuring that we get a clean audit. When one looks at the next slide, which is slide 12 on your PECs, this slide compares our performance over a 5-year period. When we look at this slide for 2018-2019, one can see that, or it shows that our performance has dropped to 54% compared to the previous year, 2017-18, which was 64%. But some notes on the slide, you know, it is important that I elaborate on this. Whilst we are sitting at 54, reality is that the 54 also includes the TERS program, which was suspended. So reality is that we needed to still keep the TERS program on the APP. So when we look at our performance without the TERS program, or if we had taken out the TERS program, our performance would be sitting at 70% instead of the 54% that is currently showing. So we believe that we have done well. However, you know, from the look on the books, it does not look good because TERS still needed to sit on the APP. Some of the limitations that we needed to highlight, which is on slide 13 in your packs, it's really about the fact that in line with Section 40B of the Employment Services Act, Productivity SA is expected to generate additional income from its services. With constrained resources, we've been able to generate the 10 million, as I have indicated. Also, we've managed to finally make sure that the business model, which we have done and which was adopted by the board, is starting to be implemented in the organization. The main purpose of us looking at our business model was just to make sure that we effectively respond to the national development agenda in a very integrated way, and just making sure that we are able to offer, you know, better services with the limited resources that we have. What is still outstanding, which is slide 14 on your pack, is the fact that you know, funding is still a problem. So I think that is one issue that we would really, really like the portfolio committee at some point to address. But as I said, I think the DG is on it, because if funding is not addressed, then it will continue being a challenge. But also, I think the biggest problem also from our side is the fact that you know, we get our income from different sources. So there is a need for a single source of funding, which we believe that will also help solve our problems. And moving more or less to closure, which is captured in your slide 16, still talks about the funding, about the funding structure, and the fact that Section 12 1A and B refers to the money which need to be allocated from UIF and compensation fund. I know I'm harping so much on this funding issue, but as I say, it is a big issue which we just cannot ignore. And lastly, I think there is a slide which Mr. Mutiba wanted me to highlight a lot, and it is our closing, or the last slide, is that, you know, the heading is areas where the portfolio committee could help, which is captured as slide 17 on your pack. It really says funding for Productivity SA should be appropriated in terms of the provisions of Section 12 of the Act. The footprint and infrastructure of Productivity SA should be expanded across the country to ensure that the services are provided equitably across all the provinces. But also, you know, the portfolio committee to help in terms of supporting Productivity SA in promoting the culture of productivity in the country, as well as that accountability for productivity at national, sector, and enterprise level. And the last part, which talks about that productivity culture at national, sector and enterprise level. We are busy formulating a framework which at some point we will be presenting, and I think that is where we would like the portfolio committee to help us in getting buy-in around this. That is the end of the presentation. Thank you.
Thank you.
I think in terms of the support and thank you for the presentation. I think in terms of the support, well, we did apologize that we couldn't honor our oversights because of the processes here in Parliament. But we did say at some point, if I am not mistaken, that when there is going to be a budget vote, try if it's possible to come, we'll try and assist you if you are to apply to have your stall here, so that we are able to, as department members will see, we will then be able to see what you are producing, which is going to assist us, because we want to this thing that a certain percentage of procurement, if members will correct me if I'm mistaken, compel departments to buy, let's say, office furniture in whatever you are producing. If my memory is serving me well, that's what you say. And I want to remind you that, please, I would have thought that you will remind us that in the budget vote, because we're going to have our first budget vote as the sixth administration this year, that is what we committed ourselves as the portfolio committee that we will do in terms of the support. And that, I think, we will, I'm just now thinking aloud, is that it then means we, even in provinces for that matter, we will have to, up to municipality, if it's possible, where you are located. I know Department of Health is doing this work that you're in terms of furniture. I think that would be very important. So that would be my proposal in acknowledging the same. Which is also bothering a little bit into a presentation to a portfolio committee. This is a workshop. But pardon you, again, as I've said yesterday, the door is open. But Vuyo said it's half open because you've got the DG that you are to. But no, I think it's fine. To understand. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks. Honourable Mayor?
Whip.
Because we introduced ourselves.
No, thanks, Chairperson. One is going to share the very same sentiments as the Chairperson to firstly welcome the presentation by Productivity SA. My input will be around the issues of fiscal capacity and financial constraints that the entity is currently faced with, which is your slide 11, 12, and 13. As per your presentation. But I'll start by actually applauding the entity for obtaining unqualified audit opinion. And I'm very happy that your financial statements are actually audited. Just for curiosity's sake, I just want
trying to get an indication from the presenter on the key spikes that were raised by the Auditor General on those 20 findings of the year 2017 and 18, and to get an indication from your side on the turnaround strategy or the measures that you have put in place to actually improve the current situation as far as the audit opinion is concerned. You can see the presentation is very comprehensive, Chair, and detailed as if we're in a portfolio committee, but I like it, I must say, because everything is here. You try by all means to be transparent as much as you can. On slide 12, on your annual performance plan, I've seen that you had 30 indicators and 7 were achieved while 6 were not. What may be the constraints or hindrances or challenges that you did face around those issues? Yeah, you did mention the issues of the funding and all that, but what are the other challenges that maybe you did not mention on this presentation, and how are you planning to improve this overall performance of the entity? You did mention on your interventions on slide 13 that one of the measures that you put in place is to develop a comprehensive business model that was adopted around 2017 and 18. Is it operational? Have you started to implement it? And what is the impact? Is it changing the fiscal and financial constraints that you guys are facing? What is happening? Is there any improvement around those issues? Then the last one, the one that you spoke about on issues of multiple revenue generating what avenues, I can't remember the terminology that you have used. How far are you with that? Are you winning? Or are there any constraints as well around those issues? Otherwise, I just want to welcome the presentation. It's quite good and comprehensive. Thank you.
Thank you, Anna. Take the last one.
Yeah, Chairperson, thank you very much, and with the presentation as well. Extensively covered by the previous speaker, Honourable Mr. Ngabane, raising the issue that I wanted to raise. But on page 12, I noticed that since 2015, there is a downward spiral of the graph that is showing. From 2015 it was 36, and 2016-17 68, but since then there has been a decline, 2017-18 of 64, and now 2018-19. And I know that you also said some of the test programs were not included. What maybe for this year they are not included, but it has been consistently going down since 2016. As I said, that it's coming right from 68% up until now to this financial year of 2018-19 at 54% from 68. What might be the contributing reasons?
Okay. Thank you, honorable members. As I said on slide 12 again, the performance when you look at 54%, reality is that 54% should or would have been 70% if TERS was not suspended. So remember when we do the APP, we do the APP, but we could not take it out of we could not take cares out of our APP when it got suspended. So that is, which is why I tried to explain that reality is that that 54%, you know, would have been 70 if CARES was not suspended. So the reason that it is down is because CARES was suspended, but we could not change the APP because it was already there. I don't know if you understand.
Sorry,
I
don't understand.
You know, again, honorable member, a big part of our issues really talk to incapacity. Like, for instance, in 2016 and 2017, we also lost a number of, you know, specialists or expertise, and purely because of the financial resources that we have. So we just have not been able to keep the staff, but also we haven't been able to provide the services that we needed to provide. So that is really the biggest issue in our space. And that's why I tried to highlight that, you know, firstly, when it comes to services that we provide, our services are limited, our footprint is limited, purely because we are not adequately funded, and it will continue being a challenge until it gets resolved. So it is a big problem for us. In terms of the business model, you asked about the business model. The business model was approved by the board in 2018, but also because of the funding was not implemented. We're only going to implement the business model now in 2019. But it was not implemented, so we'll be able to report on its successes, I think, in the next financial year, because in terms of implementing it and putting together structures of the different regions, we will only be doing that now in 2020-21. Asked, I think it was a similar question that was asked around slide 12 about the APPs and why we are dropping. So I think I've addressed that. Is there any other that I haven't answered on your side?
I suppose just the one issue on the self-generation.
Oh,
yeah.
We do a lot in terms of trying to get businesses out of, out of the normal things that we do. Like, for instance, I'll make an example. We currently have a project which we would like to implement in the Western Cape, which if we were to implement, like, for instance, we have been approached by the Western Cape government to look at their defaulters, as in municipality account defaulters. They want us to assess, all the companies that default. They have promised to pay us 2 million, which we can be able to do 30 assessments based on that. But we will not be able to implement the intervention, so we'll be able to just assess. But because of financial constraints, we will not be able to come up with interventions. We will be able to do, you know, the assessments only. So reality, again, is as much as we get companies or work from the business, from the private sector or the municipalities, some of the work becomes constrained, again, by financial challenges. In fact, earlier yesterday, we actually discussed that with Mr. Marubin, you know, to say if we could get some money to implement the assessment that we will be doing, then we'll be able to generate even more. So I think it still comes back, honorable member, to the fact that as much as we can get businesses, but we do not implement a lot of the businesses that we get because of financial constraints.
Okay. You can switch off if you want. Do you want to follow up? I see the eye contact.
There is one omission or one question that she did not respond on is around the issue of the spikes. Are you defining?
Sorry, on spikes, sorry. Or Chapson?
Let me ask that. About the issues that were raised, but just honourable member, expand on it. So.
On your slide, I can't remember whether it's 11, 12, or 13. Yeah. Your report or your presentation indicates that you obtained unqualified audit opinion. And with 9 findings compared to the 20 findings in 2017-18. So I just requested that you perhaps share with the committee what were those 20 findings, if you are in a position to respond to that question now.
Okay. Some of the findings we had before were findings that related to, I think, the issue of the UIF funding that was used for another purpose, which was investigated and it was sorted out. But a lot of that one came from that. Because if you remember, there was an issue where monies that were transferred for UIF were used for other purposes, which was to pay staff. There was an investigation or an audit that was done, which eventually cleared Productivity SA, but it did affect our audit findings. So that was the biggest issue. So it was issues of governance more than anything. It was really issues of governance. I'm not sure if I've answered that the way you...
Let's accept the answer. Any other questions? Is there one? Okay.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to make a follow-up on the earlier question that was raised, the one that relates to support to municipalities, but not specifically to municipalities, but it's just a broad principle that I want to check whether, for instance, is it not going to be helpful for the entity to continue to pursue the support that it designs for such institutions on the basis that it can link those to the added mandate of the department. No limit to the question. Good show with the data. I hope you get what I'm asking.
Yeah. Do you?
Is it a question or?
I thought it's a comment.
The point is basically to look at it. I get the point that there are financial constraints for them to roll out whatever intervention they would want. But the question is whether, for instance, notwithstanding that, can they still pursue such projects? Yeah, such that they are able, therefore, to look at it differently now, without them paying. But like, for instance, see, if I got it correctly, unless I got it wrong, there was a rebate of 2 million. Yeah. From the institution. But I was saying now, driven now by the principle of the extended or expanded mandate of the department, can they still pursue it? And, but the context now is not for them to put money in, but to rather help the institution, but also design opportunities for employment opportunities.
Yeah. Well, it's put it something for you to consider.
Yeah.
I don't know if you want to respond.
Yeah, I think, Honourable Member, point is taken, and definitely, I mean, like, for instance, we also have other projects that we've done in the Western Cape, in Worcester. I mean, there's one, the Cape Agulhas Municipality, where they pay for the services, and that is where we've been able to generate that additional income that I highlighted earlier. So it is a strategy that we really want to pursue strongly. So, yeah.
Thanks a lot for the presentation. Much appreciated. We're now going to move over and to the NEDLAC presentation. I hope it's already up. And I'm going to head over to Nobuntu.
Chair, thank you very much. And greetings once again to the members.
You may continue, ma'am.
And thank you for the opportunity that you've given us to present on NEDLAC. I will try to be short as per the brief from the chairperson. NEDLAC will provide 8 slides, which according to the brief. However, I understand from the discussions that took place here yesterday that there is some information that it might be necessary for me to add, so I'll try to fill in those gaps. So in terms of the presentation, the first slide just talks to what the table of content is, and the second slide talks to the background of NEDLAC, that NEDLAC was established in 1994 through the NEDLAC Act, and that's when we had just recently got our democratic elections and the national government took power. And at that time there was a realization that South Africa was not only dealing with the triple challenges of poverty, unemployment and inequality, but also wrestling with the legacy of colonialism and apartheid, which is the foundation of these challenges. So as such, NEDLAC was established as a social dialogue institution in order to address these social and economic challenges. And NEDLAC, therefore, is a vehicle by which government, labor, business, and community organizations seek to cooperate through problem solving, negotiation, and various engagements on economic, labor, and development issues which are facing the country. The third slide talks to the vision and mission of NEDLAC, which in terms of the vision, NEDLAC seeks to promote growth, equity, and participation through social dialogue, and its mission is to give effect to the NEDLAC Act by ensuring effective public participation in labor markets, socio-economic policy and legislation, and also to facilitate consensus and cooperation between the NEDLAC social partners in dealing with socio-economic challenges. I won't bore you with the values, they are on the screen. And then in terms of the constitutional and legal mandate of NEDLAC, NEDLAC derives its mandate from the Constitution of South Africa, as well as the NEDLAC Act 35 of 1994, the Labour Relations Act, and the Founding Declaration, NEDLAC Constitution, and the NEDLAC Protocol. And then from the legal mandate, NEDLAC strives to promote the goals of economic growth through participation in socio-economic decision-making and seeks to reach consensus and conclude agreements pertaining to social and economic policy. Consider all proposed legislation relating to labor market policy before being tabled in Parliament. And then consider all significant changes to social and economic policy before implemented or introduced in Parliament, and to encourage and promote the formulation of coordinated policy on social and economic matters, and lastly, to resolve socio-economic disputes through the Section 77 process. And Chief, if you can just allow me to make a certain emphasis on this slide, is that you will notice where it comes to the third bullet on labor legislation. It says consider all proposed legislation. So in this regard, it is mandatory for the Minister of Labor to table at NEDLAG every single policy that relates to the department. Whereas other social and economic policy, there is a room for the departments that are responsible for those to decide to say, should we table this at NEDLAG or should we not? And when we get to the challenges, I will explain why this particular, the fourth bullet then becomes a challenge. And then if I can also explain in terms of resolving socio-economic disputes through Section 77, this chair is a section that is provided for in the Labour Relations Act, which makes room for all registered trade unions and federations to table concerns or an application which is referred to as a Section 77 application at NEDLAG on issues that they would deem to be posing challenges to the economy, on the economic and social, on socio-economic matters. For example, if we look at the recent upcoming protest action here in the Western Cape on the state of public transport, that process has gone through this Section 77 process, whereby Labour tables this issue to say we have got challenges in terms of the transport in the Western Cape, and respondents to say these are the departments that we want you as NEDLAG to bring on board, and then we can have a dialogue around those issues and see how we try to resolve those issues. So proposals are put on the table, and if a process after those deliberations leads to an amicable resolution, the applicant and the respondents agree to say, okay, now this issue is resolved, there wouldn't be that protest action. However, if after the consideration of that particular notice, there's still disagreements where the applicant feels that the issues have not been fully resolved, then NEDLAG issues a certificate to say that this matter has been considered and there has been no sufficient resolution. As such, there is a protected protest action that is granted, and then there are other processes, of course, that the applicant would have to follow in order to ensure that that protest action happens if they, should they wish to still go on a protest action in that regard. And if that applicant goes on a protest action without having followed that particular issue, then the workers are not protected, so the employer can actually take adverse actions against the employees who participate in that protest action, which is not protected. Then the next slide talks to the structure at length at NEDLAG. NEDLAG has four constituencies, being business, labor, government, and community, and business is represented by Business Unity South Africa, and labor currently is represented by Congress of South African Trade Unions, National Council of Trade Unions, which is NACTU, and FEDUSA. I must also mention to you, Chair, that there is an application at NEDLAG from SASTU that is still being considered. There was information that was requested, which we are still awaiting from SACTU in order for that final decision to be made. And then from government, they are lead departments, which is the main one is the Department of Employment and Labour. My slide still refers to Department of Labour. And then there is the Department of Trade, Industry and Competition, and the Department of Public Works and Infrastructure, National Treasury, and of course there are other departments that do come to NEDLAG as and when need shock of our electricity supply. There was an urgent meeting that was called by the Executive Council for the for Minister Gordon, Minister Matashe, and Minister of Minister Mboweni is to come and deliver it to say how do we resolve this crisis around Eskom as well as generally the state-owned enterprises. So it doesn't, this slide doesn't limit the participation of government departments of NetLink to those four. However, there are other departments that do come to NetLink as and when need arise. And then in terms of community, they are those sectors which are provided in the slide with Women's Coalition, Women's National Coalition, South African National Civics Organization, South African Youth Council, Disabled People of South Africa, the National Cooperative Association of South Africa, and the Financial Sector Campaign Coalition. And then the slide on the, I mean the part on the right-hand side of the slide just talks to now the governance structures within NetLink to say that we have a national summit that is convened on an annual basis which brings various players to come and engage on a number of issues. In the last year's summit, the theme was focusing on the fourth industrial revolution and its impact on the future of work. And then we have the Executive Council, which is a senior governance structure at NetLink. And in EXCOS, there is a representation of all those four constituencies. And there is the Management Committee, which is also a representative of all the four. And then there is a chamber. So in chambers, that's where the actual state work happens. So there is a Development Chamber, Trade and Industry, Public Finance and Monetary Policy, and Labour Market Chamber. And then NetLink has the Secretariat, which is a permanent staff that is based at, in Johannesburg, which coordinate and ensure the facilitation of all these social dialogue engagements. And then I have added to chair some information on which I wanted to talk on, taking from your brief this morning, in terms of the policy processes to say is it sufficient or is there room to amend how things are done at NetLink. So in terms of policy engagement, there would be a policy proposal or legislation that is tabled either by government, labor, business or community at NetLink. Usually it is often government who tables the policy or legislation. And then once that policy has been tabled, the parties agree at the beginning to say how long should this engagement be. Often it's about around 6 months, looking at the intensity that is required, and if there are a longer engagement process or research that will be necessary, then those time frames can be extended. And then there's also terms of reference that are drafted and agreed up front. And from engagement part of it is that each of the social partners would have to send individuals or representatives with mandate so that when they engage, they don't have to constantly go back and say, no, but we don't have mandate on this issue. And then once the process has been finalized in terms of the engagement of NetLink, there is a NetLink report that is developed, which is agreed and ratified by the senior governance structures. And that report outlines the areas of agreement and disagreement. So as engagements happen, there are, for example, instances where certain clauses, all parties agree to say this clause is fine, we agree with it. And in certain instances, there would be, for example, an instance where one constituency would say, no, but we propose an amendment even to this clause, and if all of them agree, then they do agree. And if after consideration of all the clauses, for example, there is some disagreements and that remain unresolved throughout the engagement process, those are included in the NetLink report to say we have engaged on this piece of legislation and these have been areas of agreement and these have been areas of disagreement. That report is submitted to the minister who has tabled that to NEDLAC, as well as the relevant portfolio committees. If it's a labor policy, so it would be also submitted to the Minister of Labor, as well as the portfolio committee on labor. And then I've touched on the work streams, which is the four chambers. When I won't dwell much on what is on the table on this work program, unless the committee feels I should. Okay. And then there is another work stream which we refer to as macro and special projects. And that one deals with the issues, for example, that would be regarded as cross-cutting. They don't fit squarely within the development chamber or public finance, but it's relevant throughout. Then those are dealt with through the macro task team. This, for example, the work that is currently at NEDLAC on this particular task team relates to comprehensive social security and retirement reforms. We've just concluded the energy task team work, and then there is a task team which is the ESCOM senior leadership task team, the governance task team, there's the work that is happening under the job summit and the NHI, as well as the I've mentioned the governance task team. So those are some of the work projects that are under that work stream. So in terms of the link between NEDLAC and the Department of Employment and Labour's mandate, is that, well, as much as the first, that slide that I've referred to earlier talks to addressing the labour laws issues, however, there is now the employment part of it. And fundamental to the work of NEDLAC is that when you talk about unemployment or employment, there is a strong relationship between job creation and economic growth. As such, most of the projects that are happening at NEDLAC would also look at the economic growth part of it, which, if with the recent example that I've made about ESCOM, is that if we are not providing businesses with electricity and they're using that as a very basic way of production, then we will not grow as a country. So we're not only dealing with the work of saying let's look at unemployment in its own, but it's to say let's look at other factors that assist us as a country to move forward in terms of dealing with unemployment. And there is also a job summit process that is happening at NEDLAC, which is in relation to the monitoring and evaluation of progress regarding the implementation of the Job Summit Agreement. And the committee may be aware that every Monday, as much as there are other processes that are happening at NEDLAC throughout the month, however, every Monday, first Monday of the month, the President comes to NEDLAC on the Presidential Working Committee to look at progress on how those agreements are being addressed, as well as to break any deadlocks, if there are any deadlocks that are created, that arise, or that it hinders progress in the implementation of the Job Summit agreement. Okay, then let's see, I'll try. On partnerships, I'm also taking cue from the initial the presenters that have spoken earlier. In terms of partnership, NEDLAC partners with a number of organizations, including the CCMA, the ILO on the Decent Work Country Program, and other government departments, as I've mentioned earlier, Productivity South Africa, as well as Proudly South African, and the UIF, and other various institutions of learning such as VES and ECT as far as the research is concerned. That's just to name but a few. In terms of performance at NEDLAC, in 2018-19, NEDLAC performed at 94% and obtained an unqualified audit opinion, by the Auditor General, and on the findings that have been raised, an action plan has been developed, which is implemented, and we are hoping we will maintain the unqualified audit opinion going forward. And then, on the priorities going forward for NEDLAC is that while there is the need to improve the capacity of social partners and of the secretariat in order to meet the strategic objectives of NEDLAC, to build research capacity and strengthen those strategic partnerships and establish new partnerships, of course, enhance communication and outreach to ensure that everyone understands, for example, if we've got pieces of legislation that have been passed through NEDLAC, they are known to say what are those pieces of legislation that have been finalized, and that the work on the national minimum wage and comprehensive social security remains one of the key engagements, as well as the NHI, and well, we are all talking tightening the belt, and NEDLAC is also not immune in that regard. And then, okay, this one of underfunding, Chair, I think that has been addressed. And sorry, CCMA, but I'm smiling on this side. that has been a problem for NEDLAC, but it's no longer a problem. We have received an allocation that we believe it will be sufficient and will enable us to drive the mandate of NEDLAC. And the issue of risk management and compliance, also that remains a key focus area, and to ensure that you also continue to consider the Section 77 notices in line with the NEDLAC protocol and the Code of Good Practice. On the challenges facing NEDLAC, we'll highlight just a few. You may have noticed, Chair, when you asked earlier, you said, where is Mr. Mkalipi? We'll be presenting on NEDLAC. Mr. Mkalipi is an acting executive director. So if there is someone acting, it clearly indicates that position doesn't have a permanent candidate there. So NEDLAC for the last year, which is 2018, I'm still operating in 2019. We're in 2020 now. In 2019, we've had acting executive directors. Mr. Tejane had his term there, and also now currently Mr. Mkalipi is acting executive director, and you also had the acting CFO, and that's following the suspension and the final outcome, which was dismissal of the CFO and the executive director. I am pleased to report to the committee that the CFO was appointed, now a permanent CFO, effective from the 1st of January. And the acting executive director will no longer be acting for long. There is a new executive director coming, who will start at NEDLAC on the 17th of... I will summarize. we'll start at NEDLAC on the 17th of February. And so that challenge, I would say, is in a way resolved. And then there is also a challenge, Chair, in certain instances where some of the NEDLAC reports which are tabled in through the portfolio committee and through the various departments, it is understood that they are not considered by Parliament. So then I guess if there is any request for NEDLAC's assistance in this regard, it would be to ask the committee to assist us in terms of the monitoring of those processes and those policies to be considered, those NEDLAC reports, before Parliament. And then another challenge is whereby some of the pieces of legislation which social partners would deem as important are not tabled at NEDLAC. And if now we link that to the initial, to that slide earlier, which was talking to consideration of some is that if a certain department feels that this one does not need to come to NEDLAC, they don't feel obligated, unlike the Department of Labor. So that is one of the challenges and social partners would seek. But please bring this document because we want to engage thoroughly on it. And then the last challenge that I would like to refer to is that the NEDLAC founding documents have not been reviewed extensively over the past years. And however, currently there is a governance task team that has been established by the Executive Council, which is looking at those NEDLAC documents, which is those funding documents, which include the NEDLAC Act, the constitutions, and various protocols within NEDLAC. I think on that note, Chair, I would like to conclude, and if there are any questions, I would obviously be happy to respond. But one of the maybe the emphasis that I would like to put, especially on that additional slide that I've added, which talks to the process of engagement at NEDLAC, is the value of those engagements. Is that in most instances, when the pieces of legislation are tabled at NEDLAC, there would be some areas which are deemed to be very thorny issues, and that would need for example, social partners would say, let's look at the constitutional or the constitutionality of this clause, and then a legal opinion would be sought. And if after that legal consultation process it is indeed found that the clause is not constitutional, the tabling party then is requested to go. And in certain instances, the tabling party would offer to say, please, let me take this bill and see how I go back home and work around it. For example, there is a climate change bill that was tabled in the Trade and Industry Chamber, and after some deliberations, government requested to say, you know, taking into account the inputs that have been provided by social partners, please give us time to go back and see how we address the gaps that are in this policy. So it is usually not a very straightforward process. Some pieces of legislation are clear and straightforward. However, there are some where upon deliberations there would be room to say, please allow us time to further make this bill to be much stronger. And that process assists in the full ownership of the bill once it has been finalized and passed by Parliament. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Shall we open for questions?
Just clarity, Chair. The first one is, I just want to understand, if she can repeat, the issue of reports that are not considered. By whom? I didn't pick that up correctly. Two, how do you ensure, that as NEDLAC, the community chamber or what? People are not there as individuals claiming that they are representing community. Do we have a process as NEDLAC of really picking that up? I think those are, and what is then going to happen to Mr. Mkalipi? Is he going to going back to where he was before he was active or protest the situation? Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions from other honourable members? I think we may proceed, ma'am.
Thank you, Chair. Let me start with the last one, Mr. Mkalifi, what will happen to him is that he's wearing two hats because he's still working in the Department of Labor. As we speak, he's in another meeting with Cabinet. So he will be going back full-time to his role as the Department of Employment and Labor. And coming to participation of community constituency, there is a slide which I've referred to. Slide 6, which indicates who represents which constituency. So at NEDLAC, the submissions of representatives are done by through the constituency office, and when that individual's name is provided to us, if it comes through the constituency office of community, then it will be taken, there will be an indication to say, for example, there is Laura Kanyaha will be now coming to represent, to serve in the department, in the development chamber, for example. And then they would indicate to say, Laura Kanyaha is coming from Women's National Coalition. So if that nomination is coming from us through the constituency office, there is no way of challenging to say, no, but you cannot bring Laura Kanyaha. So it doesn't happen that we just get someone coming and say, I'm coming to represent the community. In terms of saying, is the community constituency inclusive enough? I think that's perhaps a different conversation. But in terms of the nominations of parties, there is no one in NEDLAC who comes wearing his or her personal cap. Everyone comes by being the name being forwarded through the constituency office and having gone through that nomination process that is followed within the community.
To follow up, it's exactly the latter, that how confident are you that inclusion can also see some of these things?
Okay.
So how confident, maybe it's for another time, that the process of you picking up that Utunjwa, as much as a nominee to have presented JKT under the emblem of, make an example, of a Women's National Coalition. I'm just making that example. So I understand the process, but the inclusivity and how sure that people are not misusing. So maybe at another time, not now.
Okay. No, I note that process. Thank you. And then also maybe if I can add to the question linked to the question that you've just indicated is in relation to that governance task team which is reviewing the very founding documents of NEDLAC and the NEDLAC Act. There is a process that will be looking at all those NEDLAC processes and identify whether there is a need to change the Act or not. So maybe that issue it will assist me as the chairperson of that task team to also dig deeper in terms of the discussions around that process. And the first question that you have as related to saying the NEDLAC reports that are not considered in Parliament. So in terms of the NEDLAC reports, for example, this relates to, I will mention, I said earlier, it appears that, so I'll use that word, appears broadly, because this is based on the report that we would receive maybe from constituencies who would have come to Parliament and say, but we were there, we as business had made this input in the report that NEDLAC has produced, and we are sure in terms of the NEDLAC report, which we were part of ratifying, that when we issued the NEDLAC report, all of those issues were there. But in the final consideration, we do not feel that the NEDLAC report has been considered. So that is the issue. So what we are looking at in terms of that particular area from NEDLAC is also to establish relationship with Parliament, that when we have tabled when we have submitted a NEDLAC report, for example, one has come to the portfolio committee, is to keep in touch with the secretariat within the portfolio committee to say how far is the consideration of this process, so that it doesn't remain an issue yabari, kasi sithi variki issue yabari, kuthwa kuthiwa kwenzeka into ethile parliament, we have a first hand information and we hear from the horse's mouth. That's one of the processes that we are looking at implementing in this year. However, of course, we would also appreciate your assistance in this regard.
Thank you very much. I don't think there's any other questions. It's 1 o'clock. I take it that after lunch, we have a fourth item. I'm told lunch is ready. There's a fourth item that we've included, which is a summary.